knock startled them both. The guard stood in the hall, damp from a recent shower and wearing some earthen military clothes found aboard the Rampion. Though his wounds were no longer visible, Cinder noticed that he was carrying himself stiffly, favoring his unwounded side. In his hands was a tray of flatbread that smelled thickly of garlic.
"Heard you talking. I thought your surgery might be finished," he said. "How's your friend?"
Cinder glanced at Wolf. He, too, would be vulnerable. Everyone in this room was lunar, she realized with a jolt. If Dr. Erland was right, they were all vulnerable now. Cinder had to swallow to unclog her voice.
"He's still alive." Leaving Wolf's side, she held a hand toward the guard.
"I'm Cinder, by the way."
He squinted. "I know who you are."
"Yeah, but I figured a formal introduction would be nice, now that we're on the same side."
"Is that what you've decided?"
Cinder frowned, but before she could respond, he'd shifted the flatbread to his other hand and grasped hers.
"Jason Clay. Honored."
Not knowing how to read his tone, which sounded almost mocking, Cinder pulled away and glanced at the doctor, who had his fingers pressed against Wolf's wrist. Evidently, he had no intention of joining the introductions. Cinder wiped her palms on her pants and eyed the tray.
"So what, you can shoot a gun, fly a spaceship, and bake?"
"This was brought by some kids." He pushed the tray toward Cinder. "They said it was for you, but I told them you couldn't be bothered."
She took it awkwardly.
"For me?"
"The cyborg, to be specific. Seemed unlikely there would be two of you around."
"Huh. I wonder why."
"I suspect it will not be the first gift you receive from the citizens of Farafra," said Dr. Erland.
"What for? These people don't know me."
"Of course they do. Or at least, they know of you. We are not so cut off from the world here as you might think. Even I had a reputation when I first arrived."
She set the tray down on the desk. "And they haven't turned you in? What about the reward money? And the fact you're a lunar? Don't they care?" Instead of answering, Dr. Erland slid his gaze toward Jason, who was now leaning statue-like beside the door. It was easy to forget his presence in a room when he stood so still and said so little. No doubt his training as a guard had taught him that. No doubt he was used to going unnoticed. But while Cinder had made the choice to trust him, it was obvious from the doctor's expression that she was so far alone in that decision.
"Right," said Jason, pushing himself off the wall. "I'll go check on your ship, make sure no one's backing out screws and calling them souvenirs."
He left the hotel room without looking back, his limp almost passing for a swagger.
"I know, he seems a little abrasive," Cinder said once he was gone.
"But he knows who I am, and he saved my life, and Wolf's. We should treat him as an ally."
"You may choose to reveal all your secrets, Miss Lin, but it does not mean I must reveal mine, or those of the people in this town."
"What do you mean?"
"The people here do not care that we are lunar, because we are not the only ones. I estimate 15% of the population of Farafra
and other neighboring oases is made up of lunars, or those of lunar descent.
This is where many of our people choose to come after they escape, and they have been immigrating here since the time of Queen Chanary,
perhaps even earlier."
15%? She asked. "And the Earthens know?"
"It is not widely discussed, but it seems to be common knowledge. They have come to live in harmony together. Once the plague struck, many lunars took to nursing the sick and burying the dead, as they themselves did not catch the sickness. Of course, no one knew they were the original carriers. By the time that theory was posed, the two races had become too intermingled. They work together now, helping each other survive."
"But it's illegal to harbor lunar fugitives. Lavanna would be furious."
"Yes, but who would tell her?
No one cares about a poor, diseased town in the Sahara."
Thought swarming, she picked up a piece of the bread, glistening with golden oil and speckled with herbs.
The soft inside was still steaming when she pulled it apart. It was a gift. From Lunars. From her own people. Her eyes widened, and she gaped up at the doctor again. Do they know about me? She sniffed.
They know that you stood up against the Queen. They know that you continue to defy her.
For the first time since she'd arrived, Cinder thought she detected a smile beneath the doctor's annoyed expression.
And I may have led them to believe that one of these days you intend to assassinate her.
What? Assassinate her?
It worked, he said with an unapologetic shrug. These people will follow you anywhere.
Chapter 22 Lunar Thaumaturge Amory Park, Your Majesty. Kai and Torin stood as the Thaumaturge glided past Nancy into Kai's office. Although Amory bowed respectfully to Kai as he came to stand on the opposite side of his desk, so low that the long sleeves of his maroon jacket nearly brushed the carpet, there was something supremely disrespectful in his air that always set Kai on edge. He had never quite been able to pinpoint what it was about this man. Maybe it was the way he always wore a faint smile at the corners of his lips. Or perhaps how that smile only reached his eyes when he was using his gift to manipulate someone.
Thank you for joining us, said Kai, gesturing to the chair across from him. Please, make yourself comfortable.
My pleasure, said Amory, settling gracefully into the offered chair. Anything for Luna's future king.
The designation made Kai squirm. It was easy to forget that he would be taking on a new title as much as Levana was. But the difference was that Luna had very strict laws governing who could be put into positions of power, and Earthens certainly did not make the cut. He would be crowned King Consort, meaning he would be a pretty figurehead with virtually no power whatsoever. Unfortunately, the Commonwealth did not have the same fail-safes put in place. Kai's great-great-great-grandfather, the country's first emperor, must have trusted his descendants to make sound decisions on their spouses.
I wanted to discuss with you a discovery recently made by the Earthen Union, Kai said, nodding at Torin.
His advisor stepped closer to the desk and set a port screen in its center. With a click, the holograph of Earth, with 327 lunar spaceships surrounding it, flickered to life above the desk. Kai watched the Thaumaturge closely, but the man did not show an iota of a reaction to the holograph, even with hundreds of yellow dots reflected like fireflies in his dark eyes. This is real-time imagery of Earth and its surrounding space, said Kai. The markers have all been confirmed to be lunar spacecrafts. Amory's cheek seemed to twitch, as though he was on the verge of laughing, yet his voice remained as smooth as caramel when he spoke.
It is a very striking picture indeed, Your Majesty. Thank you for sharing it with me.
Clenching his teeth, Kai lowered himself into his own chair. He was tempted to keep standing as a show of power, but he'd been around Lunars enough to know that such mind games rarely had any effect. And at least when he was sitting, he could pretend to be comfortable. Pretend that he hadn't been dreading this conversation all day. You're very welcome, Kai deadpanned. Now perhaps you can explain to me what they're all doing up there.
Recreation.
Amory leaned back, leisurely crossing his legs.
We have many wealthy families on Luna who enjoy the occasional holiday cruise through our galaxy. I'm told it can be very relaxing.
Kai narrowed his eyes.
And these holiday cruises routinely bring them within 10,000 kilometers of Earth,
where they remained anchored for days.
I am sure the view afforded them by such a location must be quite lovely.
One side of Amory's mouth quirked.
Breathtaking sunrises, I'm told.
Interesting, because all 327 of these ships bear the insignia of the Lunar Crown. It seems to me that these are actually Crown-sanctioned ships, either conducting some sort of surveillance on the Earthen Union, or preparing an attack should war be declared. Amory's expression remained neutral.
My mistake. Perhaps I should have said that we have many wealthy Crown-sanctioned families who enjoy the occasional holiday.
They held each other's gazes for a long moment, while the holographic oceans sparkled beneath the sun, while the white clouds swirled through the atmosphere.
I don't know why Queen Levana has chosen to threaten us at this time and in this manner, Kai finally said. But it is an unnecessary show of force, and one that trivializes all that we are attempting to accomplish with our peaceful negotiations. I want these ships to return to Luna within the next 24 hours.
And if Her Majesty refuses?
Kai's fingers twitched, but he forced them to relax.
Then I cannot take responsibility for the actions of the rest of the Union. After the lunar attacks that occurred on the soil of all six Earthen countries, it would be within the jurisdiction of any one of my peers to meet this blatant threat of war with their own show of force.
Forgive me, Your Majesty. Did you not say before that these lunar ships had entered into the territorial boundaries of the Earthen Union?
Surely if Her Majesty was aware that we have intruded your legal atmosphere space, she would have them removed at once.
He leaned forward, showing a flash of white teeth.
You are insinuating that Luna has trespassed into your legal boundaries, aren't you?
This time, Kai couldn't keep his hands from curling into fists beneath the desk. At this time, they are outside the territorial boundaries, but that does not...
So you're saying Luna has committed no crime as laid out by the Union's own law?
Then how exactly would a show of force against these ships be warranted?
We will not be bullied into accepting any more of your demands, said Kai. Her Majesty must know that she is already walking a very narrow tightrope. My patience is wearing thin, and the Union is tired of bowing to Levana's every whim, only to have her gratuitous displays of power thrown into our faces again and again.
Queen Levana has no more demands to make of you, said the Thaumaturge. The Commonwealth has been exceedingly accommodating to our requests, and I find it unfortunate that you see the presence of these thus far peaceful lunar ships as threatening.
If they aren't there to send us a message, then why are they there?
Amory shrugged.
Perhaps they are waiting for the finalization of the peace alliance between Luna and the Commonwealth. After all, once Her Majesty has signed your Treaty of Bremen, peaceful travel between our two nations will be made possible, even encouraged. He smirked. And the Commonwealth really is so beautiful this time of year.
Kai's stomach writhed as the Thaumaturge uncrossed his legs and stood.
I trust that will be all, Your Majesty, he said, tucking his hands into his wide red sleeves. Unless you also wanted to discuss the approved symphony numbers to be played during the wedding feast.
Flushing, Kai pushed himself off his chair and turned off the holograph.
This is not the end of this discussion.
Amory politely lifted his head.
If you insist, Your Majesty, I will inform my queen that you wish to discuss this matter with her in due course, though perhaps it would be prudent to wait until after the ceremony. As it is, she is quite distracted.
He bowed, and when he stood tall again, his face had taken on a taunting grin.
I will be sure to give my queen your love next I speak with her.
Kai was shaking with rage by the time Amory strode out of his office.
How was it that Lunars didn't even have to use their mind powers, and they still drove him mad every time he talked to them?
He had the sudden urge to throw something, but the port screen he was holding belonged to Torin, so he kindly passed it back to his advisor instead.
Thanks for all your help, he muttered.
Torin, who hadn't said a single word during the meeting, loosened his necktie.
You did not need my help, Your Majesty. I could not have argued your points any better than you did.
He sighed and clipped the port to his belt.
Unfortunately, Thaumaturge Park made all very sound points himself. In the eyes of intergalactic law, Luna has not yet committed a crime. At least, not in the case of these ships.
Maybe the intergalactic laws need to be revisited.
Perhaps, Your Majesty.
Kai collapsed back into his chair. Do you think he was just trying to get a rise out of me? Or are all those ships really going to invade the Commonwealth once the alliance is forged? Somehow, I just assumed Lavanna would be content to call herself Empress. I didn't think she'd want to bring her whole army here and let them make themselves right at home. Saying the words out loud made him flinch with how naive he sounded. Kai cursed beneath his breath. You know, I'm beginning to think I entered into this marriage thing a bit hastily.
You made the best decision you could at the time.
Kai rubbed his hands together, attempting to dispel the feeling of vulnerability that the Thaumaturge's presence had given him. Torin, he said, sliding his eyes toward his advisor, if there was a way to avoid this marriage, and keep us from going to war, and get that antidote, you would agree that that would be the best course of action, wouldn't you? Torin lowered himself slowly into the chair that the Thaumaturge had vacated.
I'm almost afraid to ask, Your Majesty.
Clearing his throat, Kai called for Nancy. A second later, her short, glossy white body appeared in the doorway. Nancy, have you found anything new? As she approached the desk, her sensor flashed once at him and once at Torin. Permission clearance for Advisor Con Torin requested. Torin's eyebrow jutted up, but Kai ignored it. Clearance granted. Nancy came to a stop beside the desk. I've run a full report on Michelle Benoit, including a detailed timeline of her activities, occupations, achievements, and military service, and biographical information on 11 persons who seemed close enough to warrant attention. My data retrieval system is broadening the search to neighbors and potential acquaintances, beginning in the year 85 TE.
Who is Michelle Benoit?
Torin asked, in a tone that suggested he didn't really want to know the answer. Michelle Benoit was born in 56 TE, said Nancy, and is noted most for her 28 years of service in the European Federation Armed Forces, 20 of which were served as wing commander. She received a Distinguished Service Medal for piloting the diplomatic mission to Luna in the year 85 TE. The mission included...
We think she may have something to do with Princess Celine,
Kai interrupted, tapping some fast instructions into the built-in net screen on his desk. A moment later, a satellite photo of farmlands in southern France appeared across the screen. She owns this farm. He pointed to a dark spot where the ground had been recently scorched. And this field is where Cinder landed the first time she returned to Earth, right before the attack. So we assume that Cinder believes that Michelle Benoit is attached to the princess as well. Torin's face darkened, but he seemed to be withholding judgment until Kai finished.
I see.
Nancy, have you found anything useful? Useful is a subjective term relative to the actions that are taken prior to receiving information, and the resulting... Nancy, have you found anything relevant?
Relevant to what? Said Torin. What are you hoping to find?
Princess Celine. Torin sighed.
Again?
Yes, again, said Kai. He gestured toward the sky. Aren't you the one who told me we had to try to stand up against Lavanna?
I didn't mean by chasing ghosts.
But think about it. She's the true heir to the lunar throne. You honestly don't think finding her would give us an advantage? Torin's mouth pressed into a thin line, but to Kai's relief, he seemed to be considering the question.
I don't want you to be distracted from the things that are truly important.
Kai snorted. The important things, like jade centerpieces and whether my wedding sash should have flying bats or a pair of cranes embroidered on it? This isn't a joke. Clearly. Rubbing his forehead, Torrin eyed Nancy for a long moment, before casting his gaze toward the ceiling.
Your Majesty, according to Lynn Cinder's own warnings, Queen Lavanna already means to murder you, because you were attempting to find the princess before. What will her retaliation be when she realizes you haven't stopped?
It doesn't matter. She already intends to kill me, so what else can she do? And Princess Selene would be the true heir. Her existence would negate any claim Lavanna has to her throne.
Torrin dropped his shoulders. And you think that by finding a girl who's, what, 15 years old?
16. A 16-year-old girl, you believe that finding her is what the Commonwealth needs right now, more than anything else?
Kai gulped, but his answer was solid.
I do.
Torrin settled back in his seat, resigned.
All right, fine. I won't try to dissuade you.
He eyed Nancy again, this time with distrust. As if this were all the android's fault.
Please, continue.
Nancy launched back into her report. Michelle Benoit disappeared from her farm on 11 August. Her identity chip was left in her home, having been removed from her wrist. Evidence did not indicate whether or not there had been a struggle. 2 weeks later, her granddaughter, Scarlett, who had lived with Benoit for 11 years, traveled from their home in Rio, France, to Paris. Tracking records indicate she was in Paris for 2 days before her identity chip went off the grid. Presumably, the chip was removed and destroyed. Timeline cross-examination indicates that her ID chip was last seen near an abandoned Paris opera house, at the same time that a nearby scan bank machine recorded what appears to be the landing and takeoff of a 214 Rampion. Satellite feeds, however, picked up no such spaceship at that location. Deductive reasoning leads me to believe that this was the ship on which Lynn Cinder is hiding, and that Scarlett Benoit may have boarded the ship at that time. Kai frowned, and was glad when even Torrin looked intrigued by this information.
Cinder made a special trip to Paris for this girl?
My logic aptitude suggests this is a possibility.
What else do we know about this Scarlett?
According to her ID records, she came to live with Michelle Benoit in 115 TE, 2 years after the recorded death of Princess Selene. Her birth date indicates that she is 18 years old. However, there is no hospital record of Scarlett Benoit's birth, and her data was not input until she was 4 years old, so we cannot confirm the validity of any of her records.
You lost me.
Scarlett Benoit was not born in a hospital, neither was her father, Luc Raoul Benoit. Without official records, we must treat any information about their births as circumspect. It is possible that everything we know about Scarlett Benoit is false information.
Kai pressed his hands onto the desk. Are you saying there's a chance this girl, this Scarlett Benoit, is really Princess Selene?
It is a possibility that cannot be proved or disproved at this time, but I have found no evidence to warrant a dismissal of this hypothesis.
Kai filled his lungs, feeling that he hadn't taken a full breath in weeks. And Cinder knows it. Cinder figured it out. And now, she has her. Cinder's found the princess.
Your Majesty, said Torrin, you are jumping to some large conclusions.
But it makes sense, doesn't it?
Torrin scowled. I will withhold my opinion on the matter until we have some information that is based on more than speculation.
Android speculation, Kai said, pointing at Nancy. It's better than regular speculation.
He pushed himself out of his chair and began to pace in front of the grand picture window. Princess Selene was alive. He just knew it. And Cinder had found her.
He almost laughed. I'm surprised to see you taking this all with such good humor, Your Majesty, said Torrin. I would think you would be horrified by this turn of events.
Why? She's alive!
If this girl is the missing princess, then she is currently being held captive by a dangerous felon, Your Majesty.
What? Cinder's not dangerous.
Torrin seemed unexpectedly furious as he, too, launched himself to his feet.
Have you forgotten that she's Lunar? She is a Lunar who had contacts working within this very palace. She coerced you, the most protected person in the country, into giving her a personal invitation to our annual ball, then infiltrated it with, I can only assume, the intention of provoking Queen Lavanna. She escaped from a high-security prison and has managed to evade capture by her entire military, which ultimately led to an attack that killed thousands of Earthens. How can you possibly say she isn't dangerous?
Kai straightened his spine. Lavanna attacked us, not Cinder. Groaning, Torrin rubbed his fingers over his temples. It had been a long time since Kai had seen that expression on his advisor. The expression that indicated he thought Kai was a moron. Indignation flared inside him.
And for the record, she declined my invitation to the ball. She only came to warn me, and Dr. Erland.
He hesitated. He still didn't know what to think about her relationship with Dr. Erland.
Lavanna wants her killed. I don't see that we've given her much choice other than to run.
Your Majesty, I worry that your feelings for this girl are causing a bias that could jeopardize your ability to make logical decisions where she's concerned.
Kai's face grew warm. Was he so transparent?
I'm still trying to find her, aren't I? I still have half the military out searching for her.
But are you trying to find her, or this princess?
He gestured at Nancy.
If they're together, what does it matter? We can find them both.
And then you will give Luna a new queen, and Lynn Cinder will be pardoned?
I don't know. Maybe. Is that such a horrible thing to hope for?
She's still one of them. You said yourself that she lied to you about everything. What do you know about her? She stole an ID chip out of a dead girl's wrist. She helped a known thief escape from prison. Do I need to go on?
Cringing, Kai spun back to face the window, crossing his arms stubbornly over his chest. He hated that every word Torrin had said was indisputable, while every hope Nancy had given him was based on vague observations and hazy guesses.
I understand that you feel partially responsible for condemning her to execution,
Torrin said, his tone growing gentler.
But you have to stop idolizing her.
Kai faced him again. I don't idolize her!
Torrin gave him a speculative look, until Kai began to grow uncomfortable.
I might admire her sometimes. But even you have to admit that it's pretty impressive what she's done. Plus, she stood up to Lavanna at the ball. You weren't impressed by that? Just a little?
Torrin buttoned his suit jacket.
My point, Your Majesty, is that you seem to be putting an awful lot of faith in a girl you know virtually nothing about, and who has caused us all a great deal of trouble.
Kai scowled. Torrin was right, of course. He didn't know anything about Cinder, no matter how much he felt that he did. But he was the Emperor. He had resources. He may not know much about Cinder, but if she could find out about the lost Lunar Princess, then he could find out more about her. And he knew just where to start looking.
Chapter 23. This time, when Kress awoke, it was not sand engulfing her, although there was plenty of that, but arms. Thorn had pulled her against him so close that she could feel the rise and fall of his chest and his breath on the back of her neck. She groggily peeled her eyelids open. Night had fallen. The moon had returned, larger than the night before and surrounded by a sea of stars that winked and glittered at them. She was deathly thirsty and couldn't find any saliva to wet her parched tongue. She started to shiver, despite the layers of sheets and blankets and the parachute and the heat rising off her scorched skin.
despite Thorn's protective warmth. Teeth rattling, she nestled against him as much as she could, his embrace tightening around her. She looked up. The stars were moving, swirling over her head like a whirlpool trying to suck the whole planet into its depths. The stars were taunting her, laughing. She shut her eyes tight and was met with visions of Sybil's cruel smile. News headlines echoed in her head, spoken in a child's nasally voice.
14 cities attacked. Largest massacre in Third Era. 16,000 deaths.
Cress. Cress, wake up. She jolted, still shaking. Thorn was hovering above her, his eyes bright with moonlight. He found her face, pressed his palm to her forehead, and cursed. You're running a fever.
I'm cold.
He rubbed her arms. I'm sorry, I know you're not going to like this, but we need to get up. We need to keep moving.
They were the cruelest words he could have said. She felt impossibly weak. Her whole body seemed to be made of sand that would blow apart with the slightest breeze.
Cress, are you still with me? He cupped her cheeks in both hands. His skin was cool, soothing.
I can't.
Her tongue stuck to the roof of her mouth when she spoke. Yes, you can. It will be better to walk at night when it's cool than to try and move during the day. You understand that, right?
My feet hurt. And I'm so dizzy.
Thorn grimaced. She thought of stroking her fingers through his hair. In all the pictures she'd seen of him, even his jail pictures, he'd been so polished, so neat. But now he was a wreck with whiskers on his chin and dirt in his hair. It did not make him any less handsome.
I know you don't want to keep going, he said. I know you deserve a rest, but if we just lie here, you might never get up.
She didn't think that sounded so awful. As the sand began to rock beneath her, she pressed her hand against his chest, seeking out the steadying heartbeat. She sighed happily when she found it. Her body began to dissolve, little grains of sand scattering.
Captain, she murmured, I think I'm in love with you.
An eyebrow shot up. She counted 6 beats of his heart before, suddenly, he laughed.
Don't tell me it took you 2 whole days to realize that. I must be losing my touch.
Her fingertips curled against him.
You knew?
That you're lonely and I'm irresistible? Yeah, I knew. Come on, Cress, you're getting up.
Her head dropped into the sand, sleep threatening to take over. If he would just lie down beside her and take her into his arms, she would never have to get up again.
Cress. Hey, no more sleeping. I need you. Remember the vultures? Cress. Vultures.
You don't need me. You wouldn't be here at all if it weren't for me.
Not true. Well, only kind of true. We've already been over this.
She shuddered.
Do you hate me?
Of course not, and you should stop wasting your energy talking about stupid things.
Scooping an arm beneath her shoulders, he forced her to sit up. She gripped his wrist.
Do you think you could ever love me back?
Cress, this is sweet, but aren't I the first guy you've ever met? Come on, up you go.
She turned her head away, dread pressing down on her. He didn't believe her. He didn't understand how intensely she felt.
Oh, spades and aces and stars, he groaned. You're not crying again, are you?
No,
she bit her lip. It wasn't a lie. She certainly wanted to cry, but her eyes were all dried up. Thorn pulled a hand through his hair, knocking away a cloud of sand.
Yes, he said firmly. We are obviously soulmates. Now please, stand up.
You've probably told lots of girls you loved them.
Well, yeah, but I would have reconsidered if I'd known you were going to hold it against me.
Misery washing over her, she crumpled against his side, Her head spun.
I'm dying,
she murmured, struck by the certainty of it.
I'm going to die, and I've never even been kissed.
Cress. Cress, you're not going to die.
We were going to have such a passionate romance, too, like in the dramas. But no, I'll die alone, never kissed. Not once.
He groaned, but it was out of frustration, not heartbreak. Listen, Cress, I hate to break this to you, but I am sweaty and itchy and haven't brushed my teeth in 2 days. This just isn't a good time for romance. She squeaked and tucked her head between her knees, trying to get the world to stop turning so fast. The hopelessness of their situation was crushing her. The desert would never end. They would never get out. Thorn would never love her back. Cress, look at me. Are you looking at me?
Mm-hmm,
she mumbled. Thorn hesitated. I don't believe you. Sighing, she pried her head up so she could peer at him, through the curtain of chopped hair.
I'm looking at you.
He crouched close to her and felt for her face. I promise I will not let you die without being kissed.
I'm dying now.
You are not dying.
But
I will be the judge of when you are dying, and when that happens, I guarantee you will get a kiss worth waiting for. But right now, you have to get up. She stared at him for a long moment. His eyes were surprisingly clear, almost like he could see her back, and he didn't flinch before her skeptical silence. He didn't grin nonchalantly or offer a teasing follow-up. He just waited. She couldn't help it when her attention drifted down to his mouth, and she felt something stir inside her. Resolve.
Do you promise?
He nodded. I promise. Shuddering at the pain that awaited her, she braced herself and put her hands out to him. The world tilted as he hoisted her up and she stumbled, but Thorn held her until she was steady. Hunger gnawed at her empty belly. Pain bit into her raw feet, shooting up through her legs and into her spine. Her whole face contorted, but she ignored it the best she could. With Thorn's help, she retied the sheet around her head. Are your feet bleeding? She could barely see them in the darkness, and they were still wrapped in the towels.
I don't know. They hurt a lot.
Your fever might be from an infection. He handed her the last bottle of water, now half full. Or you're dehydrated. Drink all of that. She paused with the water bottle already tipped against her mouth, carefully, so as not to lose a single drop. It was a tempting offer. She could drink it all and still be thirsty, but... All of it, said Thorn. She drank until she could stop without her throat crying for more.
But what about you?
I've had my fill. She knew it wasn't true, but her tolerance for selflessness lessened with every gulp, and soon she'd done as he asked and drank it all. She stood wavering on her feet with the bottle turned up to the sky, hoping to capture another drop until she was sure there was nothing left. She swooned, longingly placing the empty bottle into the blanket sack on Thorn's shoulder. Peering up the horizon, she spotted the mountainous shadows still so far away. Thorn picked up his cane and she forced herself to take in 3 solid breaths before she started, hoping they would give her courage. She estimated the amount of steps it would take to reach the next sand dune, and then began counting. 1 foot in front of the other. Warm air in, warm air out. The fantasy of being a brave explorer had long since dissipated, but she still clung to the knowledge that Thorn was relying on her. She plodded up the dune as her teeth began to chatter again. She stumbled twice. She tried to call up comforting daydreams, a soft bed, a worn blanket, sleeping in well past the sunrise, in a softly lit room where flowers grew outside the windowsill. Waking up in Thorn's arms, his fingers stroking the hair off her brow, his lips pressing a good morning kiss against her temple. But she couldn't hold on to them. She had never known a room like that, and the hard-earned visions were too quickly overshadowed by pain. One dune came and went. She was already panting. Two dunes. The mountains lingered tauntingly in the distance. Each time they topped one, she would focus on the next.
"We'll just crest that hill, and then I'll sit for a minute. Just one more."
But instead of letting herself rest when the goal was reached, she chose another and kept going. Thorne didn't comment when she slipped and landed on her knees. He just picked her up and set her back on her feet. He said nothing when her pace slowed to a mere crawl, so long as they didn't stop. His presence was reassuring, never impatient, never harsh. After ages of delirious, mind-numbing progress through the sand, when she felt as though every limb were about to fall off, the sky to the east began to brighten, and Cress realized that the landscape was changing. The sand dunes were becoming shorter and shallower, and, not far in the distance, they seemed to end in a long, flat plain of rocky red soil, dotted with scarce, prickly shrubs. Beyond that began the foothills of the mountains. She glanced at Thorne and was surprised to catch the evidence of exhaustion etched into his features, though he replaced it with steadfast determination as they came to a stop. She described the sight as well as she could.
"Can you guess how long it will take to reach those shrubs?"
She estimated, unable to bury the panic that it would turn out to be another illusion, and that the respite of sand and swells would flee farther away with every step they took.
"No," he nodded. "That's all right. We'll try to get to them before it gets too hot. We might be able to get some dew off their branches."
Dew. Water. Even just a lick. Just a taste. Never again would she snub a single muddy gulp. She started again, her legs screaming with the first few steps, until they began to numb again to the endless walking. Then, her eye snagged on something big and white, and she froze. Thorne crashed into her, and Cress would have collapsed if he hadn't wrapped his arms around her shoulders, steadying her.
"What's wrong?"
"There's an animal," she whispered, afraid to startle the creature that stood at the top of the dune. It had already seen them and was staring serenely at Cress. She tried to place it with what she knew of earth and wildlife. A goat of some sort? A gazelle? It had slender white legs atop enormous hooves and a rounded belly that showed the edges of ribs. Its calm face was tan, with swaths of black and white, like a mask around its eyes. Two towering spiral horns twisted up from its head, doubling its height. It was the first earthen animal she had ever seen, and it was beautiful and regal and mysterious, watching her with dark, unblinking eyes. For a moment, she imagined that she could speak to it with her mind, ask it to lead them to safety. It would recognize the goodness inside her and take pity like an ancient animal goddess sent to guide her to her destiny.
"An animal?" Thorne said,
and she realized he'd been waiting for her to further explain what she was seeing. "It has long legs and horns and it's beautiful."
"Oh, good. We're back to this again."
She could hear the smile in his tone, but she dared not take her gaze from the creature, lest it dissolve into the air like a phantom.
"Could mean there's a water source nearby," Thorne mused. "We should keep going."
Cress took a tentative step forward. She felt the slip of sand more keenly than she had before, and recognized just how clumsy she and Thorne were, stumbling and scrambling over the dunes, while this creature stood so elegant and calm. The creature tilted its head, not moving as Cress inched closer. She didn't realize she was holding her breath until the beast's eyelids flickered, and it turned its head towards something on the other side of the dune. The crack of a gunshot rang out across the desert. Chapter 24. The creature balked and tumbled down the dune, blood dripping from the wound in its side. Cress cried out and fell backward. Thorn pulled her down into the sand. "Cress, are you all right?" She was shaking, watching as the animal fell and rolled the rest of the way, gathering clumps of sand on its hide. She wanted to scream, but any noise was paralyzed inside her, and she could think of nothing but that the animal had wanted to say something to her, and now the world was tilting and fading, and she was going to be sick, and there was blood in the sand, and she didn't know what happened, and... "Cress! Cress!" Thorn's hands were on her, searching, and she realized dully that he thought she had been shot. She grabbed his wrists, holding them tight and trying to convey the truth through her grip when words wouldn't come to her.
I'm all...
She paused. They both heard it, panting, along with the slip and scramble of footsteps. Cress cowered, pressing into Thorn's embrace as terror washed over her. A man appeared at the top of the dune, carrying a shotgun. He saw the animal first, dying or dead, but then spotted Cress and Thorn from the corner of his eye. He yelped, barely keeping his balance, and gaped at them. His eyebrows disappeared beneath a gauzy headdress. His brown eyes and the bridge of his nose were all she could see of his face. The rest of him, covered in a robe that draped nearly to his ankles, protected him from the harsh desert elements. Beneath the robe peeked a pair of denim pants and boots that had long been sun-bleached and caked with sand. He finished his own inspection of Cress and Thorn and lowered the gun. He began to speak, and for a moment, Cress thought that the sun and exhaustion had driven her mad after all. She didn't understand a word he said. Thorn's grip tightened on her arms. For a moment, the man stared at them in silence. Then he shifted, his eyebrows lowering and revealing flecks of gray in them.
"Universal, then," he said, in a thick accent that still made it a struggle to capture the words.
He scanned their ragged clothes and sheets.
"You are not from here."
"Yes, sir," said Thorn, his voice rusty. "We need help. My wife and I were attacked and robbed 2 days ago. We have no more water. Please, can you help us?"
The man squinted.
"Your eyes..."
Thorn's lips puckered. They'd been trying to hide his new disability, but his eyes still looked unfocused.
"The thieves gave me a good blow to the head," he said, "and my sight's been gone ever since, and my wife has a fever."
The man nodded.
"Of course. My..."
He stumbled over the language.
"My friends are not far. There is an oasis near here. We have a camp."
Cress swooned. "An oasis? A camp?"
"I must bring the animal,"
the man said, tilting his head toward the fallen creature.
"Can you walk maybe 10 minutes?
Thorn rubbed Cress's arms.
"We can walk."
The 10 minutes seemed like an hour to Cress as they followed the man through the desert, treading in the wake carved out by the animal's carcass. Cress tried not to look at the poor beast, keeping her thoughts instead on the promise of safety. When she spotted the oasis, like paradise before them, a sudden burst of joy clawed up and out of her throat. They'd made it.
"Describe," Thorn murmured, gripping her elbow.
"There's a lake," she said, knowing that this one was real, and not sure how she ever could have confused that vague mirage with something so stark and vibrant. "Blue as the sky, and surrounded by grasses and maybe a few dozen trees. Palm trees, I think. They're tall and skinny and..."
"The people, Cress. Describe the people."
"Oh," she counted. "I can see 7 people. I can't tell their genders from here. Everyone is wearing pale-colored robes over their heads, and there are, I think, camels tied up near the water. And there's a fire, and some people are setting out mats and tents. And there's so much shade."
The man with his kill stopped at the bottom of the slope.
"The man is waiting for us," Cress said.
Thorn bent near to her and placed a kiss against her cheek. Cress froze.
"Looks like we made it, Mrs. Smith."
As they got closer to the camp,
the people stood. Two members of the group walked out into the sand to greet them. Though they wore their cloaks over their heads, they'd pulled the covers down around their chins, and Kress could see that one of them was a woman. The hunter spoke to them in his other language, and a mixture of sympathy and curiosity entered the faces of these strangers, but not without a touch of suspicion. Though the woman's eyes were the sharpest of the group, she was the first to smile.
"What a trial you've been through," she said, with an accent not quite as heavy as the hunter's. "My name is Gina, and this is my husband, Niels. Welcome to our caravan. Come. We have plenty of food and water. Niels, assist the man with his bag."
Her husband came forward to take the makeshift sack off Thorn's shoulder. Though it had become lighter as their water had disappeared, Thorn's face was one of relief to have the weight gone.
"We have some food in there," he said. "Preserved nutrition packs, mostly. It's not much, but it's yours, if you'll help us."
"Thank you for the offer," said Gina. "But this is not a negotiation, young man. We will help you."
Kress was grateful that no questions were asked as she and Thorn were led to the fire. The people shifted, eyeing them curiously as they made room on thickly woven mats. The hunter left them, dragging the animal's carcass to some other corner of the camp.
"What kind of animal was that?"
Kress asked, eyes stuck to the path left by its body.
"Desert Adex," said Niels, handing her and Thorn each a canteen full of water.
"It was beautiful."
"It will also be delicious. Now drink."
She wanted to mourn the animal, but the water was a blessed distraction. She dragged her attention to the canteen and did as she was told, drinking until her stomach ached from fullness. The people remained largely silent, and Kress felt the presence of their curiosity and stares closing in around her. She avoided meeting their eyes, and unconsciously crept closer and closer against Thorn, until he had no choice but to put an arm around her.
"We're deeply grateful to you," he said, offering an easy smile to no one in particular.
"It was very lucky that you found us, or that Quende found you," said Gina. "The desert is not a kind place. You must have a very lucky star."
Kress's lips tugged into a smile.
"You're very young."
The words sounded accusatory to Kress's ears, but the woman's face was kind.
"How long have you been married?"
"Newlyweds," said Thorn, giving Kress a squeeze. "This was supposed to be our honeymoon. So much for that lucky star, I guess."
"And I'm not as young as I look,"
Kress added, feeling like she had to offer something to the act. But her voice squeaked, and she quickly regretted speaking.
Gina winked. "You'll be grateful for that youthfulness someday."
Kress lowered her gaze again, and was glad when a wide spoon and a bowl of steaming food was set before her, smelling exotic and spicy and rich. She hesitated, and risked a sideways glance at the woman who had handed it to her, not sure if she was supposed to share or pass it to the next person, or eat very slowly and delicately, or... But within moments, everyone around the fire was enjoying their own food with relish. Flushing with hunger, Kress pulled the bowl onto her lap. She nibbled slowly at first, trying to identify the earthen foods. Peas she easily recognized. They had those on Luna, too. But there were some other sort of vegetables that she didn't know, mixed with rice and covered in a thick, aromatic sauce. She scooped out a chunk of something yellowish and firm. She bit into it, and discovered it was tender and steaming on the inside.
"Don't they have potatoes where you come from?"
Kress jerked her head up and saw Gina watching her curiously. She gulped.
"This sauce," she said quietly, hoping Gina wouldn't notice her evading the question. "Potatoes, of course."
Luna's potatoes were a darker color with a flakier texture.
"What is it?"
"Just a simple curry. Do you like it?"
She nodded enthusiastically.
"Very much, thank you."
Realizing that all eyes had turned to her again, she hastily shoveled the rest of the potato into her mouth, though the spices were making her cheeks flush. As she ate, a plate of dried meats was passed to her. She did not ask from what animal. And then, a bowl filled with a juicy orange fruit and sweet, green-tinted nuts that were full of so many more flavors than the protein nuts Sybil had often brought for her.
"Are you traders?" Thorn asked, accepting the handful of shelled nuts that Cress pressed into his palm.
"We are," said Gina. "We make this trek 4 times a year. I am upset by the threat of thieves. We haven't had such trouble in ages."
"Desperate times," said Thorn with a shrug. "If you don't mind my asking, why camels? It makes your way of life seem very second era."
"Not at all. We make our living serving many of the smaller communities in the Sahara, many of which don't even have magnets on their own streets, much less on the trade routes between them."
Cress noticed Thorn's hand tightening around his bowl. The Sahara. So, her stargazing had been correct. But his expression remained impassive, and she forced hers to do the same.
"Why not use wheeled vehicles, then?"
"We do, occasionally," said one of the men, "for special circumstances. But the desert does harsh things to machinery. They're not as reliable as the camels."
Gina took a few slices of the sticky sweet fruit and added it to the top of her curry.
"This may not be a luxurious life, but we stay busy. Our towns rely on us."
Cress listened attentively, but kept her attention on the food. Now that they were safe, sheltered, and fed, she was developing a new fear, that at any moment one of these men or women might look at her and see something different, something not quite earthen.
Or that they would recognize Thorn, one of the most wanted fugitives on the planet. Whenever she dared to look up, she found their focus pinned on her and Thorn. She hunkered over her bowl of food, trying to fend off their prying eyes, and hoped that no one spoke to her. She became certain that any word she said would mark her as different, that simply by meeting their gazes, she would give herself away.
"Not many tourists come through here," said Gina's husband, Niels. "Any foreigners are usually just here for mining or archaeology. This side of the desert's been almost forgotten since the outbreak started."
"We heard the outbreaks aren't half as bad as rumored," said Thorn, lying with an ease that astonished Cress.
"You heard wrong. The plague outbreak is as bad as they think. Worse."
"Which town were you traveling to?" asked Gina.
"Oh, whichever one you're going to," Thorn said, not missing a beat. "We don't want to burden you. We'll take our leave in any town with a net screen. You wouldn't happen to have any port screens on hand, would you?"
"We do," said the oldest woman, perhaps in her 50s. "But net access is fickle here. We won't have a good connection until we get to Kufra."
"Kufra?" "The next trading town," said Niels. "It will take us another day to get there, but you should be able to find whatever you need."
"We'll rest today and tonight and set out tomorrow," said Gina. "You need to replenish yourself, and we want to avoid the high sun."
Thorn flashed a most grateful smile.
"We can't thank you enough."
A bout of dizziness spun through Cress's head, forcing her to set down the bowl.
"You don't look well," someone said, she wasn't sure who.
"My wife was feeling ill earlier."
"You should have said. She could have heat sickness."
Gina stood, setting aside her food.
"Come, you should not be so near the fire. You can use Quende's tent tonight, but you should drink more before you sleep. Jamal, bring me some damp blankets."
Cress accepted the hand that pulled her to her feet. She turned to Thorn and gathered her courage to give him a small, non-theatrical kiss on the cheek. But as soon as she bent toward him, blood rushed to her head. The world flipped over. White spots pricked at her eyesight, and she collapsed into the sand.
Chapter 25. Cinder pulled back the drapes and stepped into the shop, holding the curtain for Jason as she surveyed the shelves around her. Jars were filled with assorted herbs and liquids, many of them labeled in a language she didn't know, although, if she stared at them for too long, her netlink would begin searching for a translation. These exotic ingredients were scattered among boxes of drugs and bottles of pills that she recognized from pharmacies in the Commonwealth, along with bundles of gauze and bandages, pasty ointments, port screen accessories designed for taking various vital stats, massage oils, candles, and anatomical models. Flecks of dust caught on a few streams of light that filtered in from dirty windows, and a fan spun lazily in the corner, doing little to dispel the dry heat. In the corner, a holograph displayed the progression of internal bleeding due to a side injury, occasionally flickering. Jason meandered toward the back of the shop, still walking with a slight limp.
"Hello?" Cinder called.
Another curtain hung over a doorway on the far wall, alongside an old mirror and a standing sink that was overgrown with a potted plant. The curtain swished, and a woman ducked through, pulling an apron over her plain jeans and a brightly patterned top.
"Coming! Coming!"
She spotted Cinder. Her eyes widened, followed by an enormous smile as she yanked the apron strings behind her.
"Welcome!"
she said in the thick accent that Cinder was becoming familiar with.
"Hi. Thank you." Cinder set a port screen down on the counter between them, pulling up the list that Dr. Erland had recorded for her.
"I'm here for some supplies. I was told you would have these things."
"Cinder Lynn!"
She raised her head. The woman was still beaming.
"Yes?"
"You are brave and beautiful."
She tensed, feeling more like the woman had threatened her than complimented her. In the moments following the unexpected statement, she waited for her lie detector to come on, but it never did. Brave, maybe. At least she could comprehend why someone would say that after they'd heard the stories about the ball. But beautiful? The woman kept smiling.
Thank you?
She nudged the port screen toward her.
"My friend gave me this list."
The woman grabbed her hands and squeezed. Cinder gulped, surprised not only by the sudden touch, but at how the woman didn't flinch when she took her metal hand. Jason leaned over the counter and slid the port screen toward the woman so suddenly that she had to release Cinder's hand in order to catch it.
"We need these things," he said, pointing at the screen.
The woman's smile vanished as her gaze swept over Jason, who was wearing the shirt from his guard uniform, freshly cleaned and patched so that the bloodstains hardly showed on the maroon fabric.
"My son was also conscripted to become a guard for Lavanna."
Her eyes narrowed.
"But he was not so rude."
Jason shrugged.
"Some of us have things to do."
"Wait," said Cinder. "You're Lunar?"
Her expression softened when she focused on Cinder again.
"Yes, like you."
She buried the discomfort that came with such an open admission.
"And your son is a royal guard?"
No, he chose to kill himself rather than become one of her puppets."
She flashed a glare at Jason and stood a little taller.
"Oh, I'm so sorry," said Cinder.
Jason rolled his eyes.
"I guess he must not have cared about you very much."
Cinder gasped.
"Jason!"
Shaking his head, he snatched the port screen back from the woman.
"I'll start looking," he said, shouldering past Cinder. "Why don't you ask her what happened next?"
Cinder glared at his back until he disappeared down one of the rows.
"Sorry about that," she said, searching for some excuse. "He's, you know, also Lunar."
"He is one of hers."
Cinder turned back to the woman, who looked offended at Jason's words.
"Not anymore."
Grunting, the woman turned to reposition the fan so Cinder could catch most of the gentle breeze.
"Courage comes in many forms. You know about that."
Pride flickered over the woman's face.
"I guess so."
"Perhaps your friend was brave enough to join her guard. My son was brave enough not to."
Rubbing absently at her wrist, Cinder leaned against the counter.
"Did something happen? Afterward?"
"Of course."
There was still pride on her face, but also anger, and also sadness.
3 days after my son died, 2 men came to our house. They took my husband out into the street and forced him to beg the Queen's forgiveness for raising such a disloyal child. And then they killed him anyway as punishment, and as a warning to any other conscripts who were thinking of disobeying the crown.
Her eyes were beginning to water, but she held on to a pained smile.
It took me almost 4 years to find a ship that was coming to Earth and willing to accept me as a stowaway. 4 years of pretending that I didn't hate her, of pretending to be one more loyal citizen.
Cinder gulped. I'm so sorry. Reaching forward, the woman cupped Cinder's cheek.
Thank you for defying her in a way that I never could.
Her voice turned to steel.
I hope you kill her.
Do you carry fentanyl 10? Asked Jason, returning to the counter and dropping 3 small boxes onto it.
Pressing her lips, the woman took the port screen out of his hand.
I will do this,
she said, slipping around the counter and heading toward the front corner of the store.
That's what I thought, he muttered.
Cinder propped her chin on her metal fist, eyeing him. I never realized Royal Guard was a mandatory position.
Not for everyone. A lot of people want to be chosen. It's a big honor on Luna.
Did you? He slid his gaze to her.
Nah, I always wanted to be a doctor.
His tone was thick with sarcasm, and yet Cinder's optobionics didn't peg it as a lie. She crossed her arms. So, who were you protecting?
What do you mean?
Something scraped against the floor, the shopkeeper shoving around dusty bins. When you were conscripted to be a royal guard, who would Lavanna have murdered if you'd refused? His pale eyes frosted over. Reaching past the counter, he angled the fan toward himself.
Doesn't matter. They're probably going to end up dead anyway.
Cinder looked away. Because he'd chosen to join her side, his loved ones could suffer. Maybe not, she said. Lavanna doesn't know that you betrayed her yet. She could think I glamored you, that I'm forcing you to help us.
And you think that will make a difference?
It might, she watched as the shopkeeper dug through a bin. A fly buzzed near her head, and Cinder batted it away. So, how does one get chosen to be a royal guard anyway?
There are certain traits they look for.
And loyalty isn't one of them?
Why would it be? She can fake loyalty. It's like with your special op friend. He would have shown fast reflexes, good instincts, and some amount of common sense. Match him up with a thaumaturge who can turn him into a wild animal, and it no longer matters what he thinks or wants. He just does what he's told.
I've seen Wolf fight it, Cinder said, feeling compelled to defend him now that Scarlet wasn't here to do it. The first time Cinder had seen Wolf, he'd been covered in blood and crouched threateningly over Scarlet, although Scarlet had always insisted that he wouldn't have hurt her, that he was different from the others, stronger. Of course, that was before Wolf had gotten himself shot, taking a bullet for a thaumaturge, moments before Scarlet was kidnapped. It's obviously not easy to do, she amended, but it is possible for them to fight against the mind control.
Lots of good that seems to have done him.
Locking her jaw, Cinder pressed her metal hand against the back of her neck, letting it cool her down. He'd rather fight and lose than become another one of her pawns. We all would.
Good for you. Not everyone's given that option.
She noticed that his hand had settled comfortably on the knife sheathed against his thigh. Clearly, Lavanna didn't want you for your chattiness. So what were the traits you possessed that made her think you'd be a good guard? That look of smug amusement returned, like he was letting her in on a private joke.
My pretty face, he said. Can't you tell?
She snorted. You're starting to sound like Thorn. She stumbled over his name. Thorn, who would never make jokes about his own charisma again. Jason didn't seem to notice.
It's sad, but true.
Cinder swallowed her sudden remorse.
Lavanna chooses her personal guards based on who makes the best wall decorations? I'm suddenly feeling better about our chances. That, and our very weak minds.
You're kidding?
Nope. If I'd been good with my gift, I might have made thaumaturge, but the queen wants her guards to be easily controlled. We're like puppets for her to shuffle around. After all, if we show the slightest resistance to being controlled, it could mean the difference between life and death for Her Majesty.
Cinder thought of the ball, when she'd had the gun and had tried to shoot Lavanna. The red-haired guard had jumped in front of the bullet without hesitation. She'd always assumed he'd been doing his duty to protect the queen, that he'd done it willingly. But now, she recognized how his movements were too jerky, too unnatural. And how the queen hadn't even flinched. She'd been controlling him. Jason was right. He'd acted just like a puppet.
But you were able to resist control on the ship. Because Thaumaturge Mira was preoccupied with your operative. Otherwise, I would have been the same brainless mannequin that I usually am.
His tone was self-deprecating, but Cinder could detect bitterness beneath it. Nobody liked to be controlled, and she didn't think anyone ever got used to it.
And you don't think they suspected that you're
a traitor?
If that's what you are.
His thumb traced around the knife handle.
My gift is pretty much worthless. I couldn't even control an earthen, much less a skilled lunar. I could never do what you do. But I've gotten pretty good at keeping my thoughts empty when the queen or thaumaturge is around. To them, I have about as much brains and willpower as a tree stump. Not exactly threatening.
Near the front of the store, the woman started humming to herself as she scavenged for Cinder's supplies.
You're doing it right now, aren't you? Said Cinder, crossing her arms. Keeping your thoughts empty?
It's a habit.
Closing her eyes, Cinder felt around for him with her thoughts. His presence was there, but just barely. She knew that she could have controlled him without any effort at all, but the energy rolling off his body didn't give anything away. No emotions, no opinions. He simply melted into the background.
Huh. I always thought your training must have taught you that.
Just healthy self-preservation.
Furrowing her brow, she opened her eyes again. The man before her was an emotional black hole, according to her lunar gift. But if he could fool Lavanna...
She narrowed her eyes. Lie to me.
What?
Tell me a lie. It doesn't have to be a big one.
He was silent for a long time, and she imagined she could hear him sifting through all the lies and truths, weighing them against each other.
Finally, he said,
Lavanna's not so bad once you get to know her.
An orange light blinked on in the corner of her vision. At Jason's mocking grin, Cinder started to laugh, the tension rising off her shoulders like heat waves off the desert sand. At least her cyborg programming could still tell her whether or not he was lying to her, which meant he hadn't been lying when he'd said he was loyal to his princess, and his princess alone. The shopkeeper returned and dumped an armful of different drugs on the counter, scanned the port screen, whistled, then drifted away again.
Now that you know all about me, said Jason, as if it were anywhere close to true. I have a question for you.
Go for it, she said, organizing the bottles into neat rows. My secrets are mostly public knowledge these days.
I may be able to hide my emotions from the queen, but I can't hide the fact that I'm lunar, and that I can be controlled by her.
But when you first came to that ball, your gift seemed non-existent.
Honestly, I thought you were earthen at first. And I know that's why the queen and thaumaturge Mira were taunting you, treating you like a shell, which you might as well have been for how powerless you were.
He stared at Cinder, as if trying to see into the mess of wires and chips in her head.
Then, suddenly, you weren't powerless anymore. Your gift was practically blinding, maybe even worse than Lavanna's.
Gee, thanks, Cinder muttered.
So, how did you do it? How could you hide that much power? Lavanna should have known immediately. We all should have known. Now when I look at you, it's practically all I see.
Biting her lip, Cinder glanced toward the mirror over the shop's small sink. She caught her reflection and wasn't surprised to find a smudge of dirt on her jaw. How long had it been there? And strands of hair falling messily out of her ponytail. True to form, the mirror showed her just as she had always been. Plain, dirty, a cyborg. She tried to imagine what it would be like to see herself as she saw Lavanna. Frighteningly gorgeous and powerful. But it was impossible with that reflection staring back at her. That was why Lavanna despised mirrors so much. But Cinder found her reflection almost comforting. The shopkeeper called her brave and beautiful. Jason called her blinding. It was kind of nice to know that they were both wrong. She was still just Cinder. Tucking a strand of hair behind her ear, she tried her best to explain to Jason the bioelectrical security system her adoptive father had invented and installed on her spinal cord. For years, it had prevented her from using her gift, which was why, until recently, she hadn't known she was lunar at all. The device was meant to protect her, not only by preventing her from using her gift so that Earthans wouldn't know what she was, but also to prevent the side effects that most lunars experienced when they didn't use their gift for long periods of time. Side effects of delusions and depressions and madness. That's why you might overhear Dr. Erland babbling to himself sometimes, she said. He didn't use the gift for years after coming to Earth, and now his sanity is... Wait. She paused, not only because Jason had spoken, but because something had changed in the air around him. A sudden spike of emotion, catching Cinder off guard. This device kept you from losing your mental stability, even though you weren't using your gift for years.
Well, it kept me from using my gift in the first place, and also protected me from those side effects.
He turned his face away from her and took a minute to school his features back into nonchalance, but it was too late. There was a new intensity behind his eyes as he grasped the implications. A device that could take away a person's lunar gift would make them all equal.
Anyway, said Cinder, rubbing the back of her neck, where the device was still installed, though now broken. Dr. Erland disabled it. My gift had been coming and going for a couple of weeks before the ball, but then all the emotional stress overwhelmed my system and the device, and there I was, fully lunar. Not a moment too soon.
She cringed, recalling the sensation of a gun pressed against her temple.
Do any more of these devices exist? He said, his eyes strangely bright.
I don't think so. My stepfather died before it was fully tested, and, as far as I know, he didn't manufacture any others. Although he may have left behind some plans or blueprints that explain how it works.
Doesn't seem possible. An invention like that, it could change everything.
He shook his head, staring into space as the shopkeeper returned and set a basket full of supplies on the counter. She grabbed the bottles from before and threw them on top, along with Cinder's port screen.
This is perfect, said Cinder, pulling the basket toward her. Thank you so much. The doctor said you could put it on his tab?
No payment from Cinder Lynn, said the woman, waving one hand while she pulled a port screen out of her apron pocket. But may I take your picture for my net profile, my first celebrity?
Cinder flinched away from her. I'm sorry, I'm not really doing the picture thing these days. The woman wilted in disappointment, tucking her port back into her pocket.
Sorry, really. I'll talk to the doctor about paying you, all right?
She hauled the basket off the counter without waiting to hear another argument.
Not doing pictures these days? Jason muttered as they hurried through the shop. How very lunar of you.
Cinder glared against the sudden burning sunlight.
Very wanted criminal of me, too.
Chapter 26. Although Scarlett's thoughts were as thick as mud, her fingers were nimble and fast, dancing through the familiar motions of powering down the pod ship. Just like all those nights she returned to the farm after finishing her deliveries.
She could almost smell the musty tang of her grandmother's hangar, combined with the fresh, earthy breeze coming off the fields. She lowered the landing gear and eased down the brakes. The ship settled, humming idly for a moment before she shut down the engine, and it fell silent. Something thumped behind her. A woman began to yell shrilly, her anger made sticky and confusing in Scarlett's cobwebbed brain. A headache began to throb in the front of her skull, gradually taking over her entire head. Scarlett flinched and leaned back in the pilot's seat, pressing her palms over her eyes to block out the pain. The swamp of confusion. The sudden, piercing light that burst through her vision. She groaned, slumping forward. No harness caught her like she'd expected, and soon she was hunched over her knees, taking full, gasping breaths as if she'd nearly drowned. Her mouth was dry, her jaw aching, as if she'd been grinding her teeth for hours. But as she held very still and choked on very deep breaths, the throbbing in her head began to subside. Her thoughts cleared, the muffled yelling sharpened and spiked. Scarlett opened her eyes. A surge of nausea passed over her, but she swallowed hard and let it pass. She knew instantly that this was not her delivery ship, and she was not in her grandmother's hangar. The smell was all wrong. The floorboards too clean.
"Want Lieutenant Hensla sent down immediately, along with a full team for scouting and ship identification."
The woman's voice shot like electricity through Scarlett's nerves, and she remembered. The ship, the attack, the gun in her hand, the bullet hitting Wolf in the chest, the sense of hollowness as the thaumaturge burrowed into her brain, took over her thoughts, took away all sense of identity and will.
"Use the shuttle's history to track the last location and see if it has any lingering connectivity to the main ship. They may have gone to Earth. Figure it out. Find her."
Scarlett raised her head enough that she could peer out of the podship's side window. Luna. She was on Luna, docked in an enclosed space that was nothing at all like the hangar she had known or the podship dock of the Rampian. It was large enough to house a dozen shuttles, and a few were already lined up alongside hers, their sleek shapes ornamented with the royal lunar insignia. The walls were jagged and black, but speckled with small, glowing lights to mimic a non-existent sky. A faint light was glowing up from the ground, so that the shadows of the podship stretched like birds of prey along the cavernous walls. At the end of the row of ships was an enormous arched doorway, embedded with glittering stones that depicted a crescent moon rising above planet Earth.
"Took this decom from the programmer who betrayed us. See if the software techs can use it to trace the companion chip."
The podship door behind her was still open, and the thaumaturge was standing just outside the ship, yelling at the people who had gathered around her. Two guards in red and gray uniforms and a middle-aged man who wore a simple belted robe and was hastily plugging information into a port screen. The thaumaturge's long white coat was smeared with blood and soaked through where it draped over her thigh. She stood slightly hunched, her hands pressed over the wound. The arch door began to open, cutting a slit through the center of the glittering earth as the doors peeled back. Scarlett ducked back down. She heard the subtle click and hum of magnets, the clatter of footsteps.
"Finally," the thaumaturge seethed. "The uniform is ruined. Cut away the material and be quick. The bullet didn't pass through, and the wound hasn't..."
She cut off with a hiss. Daring to glance up, Scarlett saw that three new people had arrived, dressed in white lab coats. They brought a hovering gurney with them, stocked with a full lab's worth of medical supplies, and were all crowded around the thaumaturge, one unbuttoning her coat while another tried to cut a square of fabric away from her pants, though the material seemed to have cemented itself to the wound. The thaumaturge recovered and rearranged her features to disguise how much pain she was in, though her olive skin had taken on a yellowish pallor. One of the doctors managed to peel the material away from the wound.
Have Sierra send for a new uniform, and contact Thaumaturge Park to inform him that there will soon be changes to our procedures for gathering intelligence in relation to the Earthen leaders.
Yes, Thaumaturge Mira, said the middle-aged man. Speaking of Park, you should know that he already had a meeting with Emperor Kaito regarding our fleet of operatives that appears to no longer be in disguise.
She cursed. I forgot about the ships. I hope he was smart enough not to tell them anything before we've established an official statement.
She paused to take in a warbling breath.
Also, inform Her Majesty of my return.
Scarlet slid down in the seat. Her eyes darted to the door on the other side of the podship. She considered starting the engine, but she had no chance of escaping in the Rampian's shuttle. They had to be underground, and the port's exit probably required special authorization to open. But if she could reach one of those other ships... Trying to take calming breaths, she inched herself over the central console, into the co-pilot's seat. She braced herself, her heart pummeling against her collarbone. She counted down from 3 in her head before unlatching the door, prying it open at glacial speeds so the movement wouldn't be noticed by the lunars behind her, slipping out and settling her sneakers onto the floor. Now she could tell where the peculiar light was coming from. The entire floor was set in glowing white tiles, making it feel as if she were walking on, well, the moon. She paused to listen. The doctors were discussing entrance wounds. The assistant was listing times for a meeting with the queen. For once, the thaumaturge had gone silent.
Breathe. Breathe.
Scarlet stepped away from the podship. Her hair was clinging to her damp neck, and she was trembling with fear and building adrenaline and the encroaching knowledge of how this would never work. She wouldn't be able to get into the lunar ship. They would shoot her in the back at any moment. Or she would get in the ship but not know how to fly it. Or the port's exit wouldn't open. But the lunars were still carrying on behind her, and she was so close. And this could work. This had to work. Crouching against the lunar ship's shimmering white body, she licked her lips and inched her fingers toward the door panel. Her hand froze. Her heart plummeted. The air around her fell silent, charged with an energy that made every hair stand up on Scarlet's arm. Her mind stayed sharp this time, fully aware of how close she had come to getting inside that ship and making a mad dash for her safety, and at the same time, fully aware that she'd never had a chance. With a snap, her hand unfroze and she dropped it to her side. Scarlet forced her chin up and, using the side of the podship for balance, she stood and turned to face the thaumaturge. Sitting on the hovering gurney, Sybil Mira had been stripped down to a light undershirt and was leaning to one side so the doctors could have access to the bullet wound. There was blood speckled on her cheek and brow, and her hair was tangled and clumped haphazardly with yet more blood. But still, she managed to look intimidating as her gray eyes held Scarlet pinned against the ship. The doctors were hunkered over her thigh, working intently, as if they were afraid she would notice they were there as they cleaned and inspected and stitched. The two guards had their guns in hand, though their stances were relaxed as they awaited orders. The assistant, who had been middle-aged and plain in every way before, had changed. Though he still wore the belted robe, he himself had become unearthly handsome. Early 20s, strong-jawed, with pitch-black hair slicked neatly back from a widow's peak on his brow. Scarlet clenched her jaw and forced her brain to remember what he looked like before, not to give any weight to his imposed glamour. It was only a small rebellion, but she embraced it with all the mental strength she had left.
"This must be the hostage taken from the cyborg's ship," the assistant said. "What shall I have done with her?"
The thaumaturge's gaze narrowed on Scarlet, with a hatred that could have melted skin off bones. The feeling was mutual. Scarlet glared right back.
"I need time to brief Her Majesty about her," said Sybil. "I suspect she will want to be present when the girl is questioned."
She twitched as pain flickered across her face. Scarlet could see the moment when the thaumaturge lost interest in Scarlet's fate, when her shoulders slumped as she drew on whatever energy she had left to lower herself fully onto the gurney.
I don't care what you do with her in the meantime. Give her to one of the families if you want.
The assistant nodded and gestured to the guards. Within seconds, they had stepped forward and pulled Scarlet away from the pod ship, locking her hands behind her with some sort of binding that dug into her forearms. By the time they began marching her toward the enormous arched doors, the doctors and the thaumaturge were already gone.
Chapter 27. Time passed in a haze, dreams and reality blurring together. Being pulled from her sleep, forced to sit up and drink some water. Snips of muddled conversations. Shivering. Hot and sweating and kicking off the thin blankets. Thorn beside her, tying a blindfold around his head. Hands holding the water bottle to her lips. Drink. 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 Eat the soup. Drink some more. Unfamiliar laughter making her curl up into a ball and burrow beneath the blankets. Thorn's silhouette in the moonlight, rubbing his eyes and cursing. Gasping for breath in the hot air, sure that she was going to suffocate beneath the blankets, and that all the oxygen would be sucked up into the dark night sky. Desperate for water. Itchy from the sand still in her clothes and hair. Light. Darkness. Light again. Finally, Cress awoke, groggy but lucid. Saliva was thick and sticky in her mouth, and she was lying on a mat inside a small tent, alone. It was dark beyond the thin fabric walls, and the moonlight spilled over the pile of clothing at her feet. She felt for her hair, meaning to strangle her wrists with it, but found it chopped beneath her ears. The memories returned, lazy at first. Thorn in the satellite, Sybil and her guard, the fall and the knife and the cruel desert stretching to the ends of the earth. She could hear voices outside. She wondered whether the night had just begun or was already ending. She wondered how long she'd slept. She seemed to recall arms around her, soft knuckles brushing sand off her face. Had it been a dream? The tent's flap opened, and a woman appeared with a tray. The older woman from the fire. She beamed and set down the food. Some sort of soup and a canteen of water.
Finally, she said in that thick, unfamiliar accent, crawling over the mounds of disheveled blankets. How do you feel? She pressed a palm to Cress's forehead. Better. Good.
How long was I?
2 days. We're behind schedule now, but no matter. It's good to see you awake.
She sat down beside Cress. It was a snug fit in the tent, but not uncomfortable.
You will have a camel to ride when we leave. We need to keep your wounds cleaned. You were lucky we got you before the infection.
Wounds? The woman gestured to her feet, and Cress bent over. It was too dark to see, but she could feel bandages. Even 2 days later, they were sore to the touch, and her leg muscles tingled from exertion.
Where's...
She hesitated, unable to remember if Thorn had given himself a fake name.
My husband... He's been entertaining us with talk of your whirlwind romance, lucky girl.
She gave a sly wink that made Cress withdraw, then patted Cress's knee. She handed the bowl of soup to her.
Eat first. If you're strong enough, you can come join us.
She scooted back toward the entrance.
Wait, I have to...
She blushed, and the woman gave her an understanding look.
I'm sure you do. Come along. I'll show you where to do your business.
There was a pair of boots by the tent's opening that were far too big for her. The woman helped Cress stuff them with cloth until they bordered uncomfortable, though the bottoms of her feet still stung. And then she led her away from the fire,
to a hole they'd dug into the sand at the edge of the oasis. Two sheets had been hung up for privacy, and there was a young palm tree to balance on while Cress relieved herself. When she was alone, the woman guided her back to the tent, and then left her alone to savor the soup. Her appetite had returned tenfold since her first meal in the oasis. Her gut felt hollow, but the broth soothed her as she listened to the chatter of strangers. She tried to pick out Thorn's voice, but couldn't. When Cress crawled out of the tent again, she saw eight forms seated around the fire. Gina was stirring a pot half buried in the sand, and Thorn sat relaxed and cross-legged on one of the mats. He had a bandana around his eyes.
"She rises!" yelled the hunter, Quende.
Thorn raised his head, and his surprise broke into a toothy grin.
"My wife?" he said, louder than necessary.
Cress's nerves crawled to find so many strangers staring at her. Her breathing became erratic, and she considered feigning a dizzy spell to seek solace back in the tent. But then, Thorn was standing, or trying to, wobbling on one knee like he might tip right over into the fire.
"Uh-oh,"
Cress darted to his side. With her help, he heaved himself up to his feet and grasped her hands, still shaky.
"Cress?"
"Yes, Cap.
You're awake, finally. How do you feel?"
He sought out her forehead, his palm landing first on her nose before sliding up to her forehead.
"Oh, good. Your fever's gone down. I was so worried."
He pulled her into an embrace, dwarfing her in his arms. Cress squeaked, but the sound was muffled in the cotton of his shirt. He released her just as quickly and cupped her face in both hands.
"My dear Mrs. Smith, never scare me like that again."
Although his act was overdone, Cress felt a jolt behind her sternum at seeing his mouth set just so, feeling his hands so tender against her cheeks.
"I'm sorry," she whispered. "I feel much better now."
"You look much better."
His lips quirked.
"At least, I'm assuming you do."
Thorn dug his toes into the sand and flicked up one end of a long stick, catching it easily.
"Come on, let's go for a walk. Try to get some real alone time on this honeymoon of ours."
He twisted his face into a wink that was obvious even beneath the blindfold. The crowd around the fire hollered as Thorn took Cress's hand. She guided him away from the taunts, glad that the night's darkness hid her burning cheeks.
"You seem to be getting around well," she said when they'd gone some distance from the fire, though she was glad when Thorn didn't release her hand.
"I've been practicing walking with a new cane. One of the guys made it for me, and it's a lot nicer than that metal one. The camp setup still confuses me, though. I swear they keep moving stuff around every time I think I've got it figured out."
"I should have been there to help you," she said as they neared the small lake. "I'm sorry I slept so long."
He shrugged.
"I'm just glad you're all right. I really was worried."
Her attention caught on their entwined fingers like a beacon. Every twitch, every heartbeat, every step was broadcast through her entire body. It wasn't long before her imagination had them lying together in the warm sand, his fingers stroking through her hair, his lips working their way along her jaw.
"So, listen," Thorn said, snapping her away from the dream. "I told everyone that once we get to town, we're going to call up my uncle in America and have him send transportation, so we won't be continuing on with them."
Cress tucked her hair behind her ears, still shaking off the tendrils of the fantasy. The touch of night air on her neck was unexpectedly pleasant.
"And you think we'll be able to contact your crew?"
"That's my hope. I mean, the ship doesn't have any tracking equipment, but given that you were able to find our location before, I thought maybe you could think of some way to at least get a message to them."
They made a full circle around the camels, who eyed them with blatant disinterest, while Cress's brain started rummaging through a dozen possible means of communicating with an untraceable ship. and what she would need to accomplish it. She hadn't been able to do it from the satellite, but with the right net access. She was grateful when they arrived at their little tent. Though the walk had been short, the large boots had already begun to burn. She sank down on the mat and pulled one off, inspecting the bandages as well as she could in the dark. Thorn settled down beside her.
Everything all right?
I hope we can find some shoes when we get to this town, she sighed dreamily. My first pair of real shoes, he smirked.
Now you're sounding like a true earthen lady.
She glanced toward the fire to make sure no one overheard them. Can I ask why you're wearing a blindfold? His finger skimmed the material. I think it was making people uncomfortable. My staring into space all the time, or looking right through them. She dipped her head, pulling off the second boot.
That didn't make me uncomfortable. I think your eyes are, well, dreamy.
His lips quirked.
So, you have noticed.
Pulling off the bandana, he tucked it into a pocket before stretching his legs out in front of him. Cress fidgeted with the blunt ends of her hair, staring at his profile with a longing that made her entire body ache. Finally, after an agonizing minute of gathering her courage, she shifted closer to him and leaned her head against his shoulder.
Good idea, he said, wrapping an arm around her waist. How could they not think that we're in love?
How couldn't they? She murmured.
She squeezed her eyes shut and tried to memorize the exact feel of him.
Cress?
Hmm?
We're good, right?
She peeled her eyes open. A crop of palm trees in front of her glowed orange in the fluttering firelight. And she heard the burst and crackle of sparks, but the noise seemed far away.
What do you mean?
I was just thinking about, you know, what you said out in the desert. I figured it was mostly the fever speaking, but even still, I have this habit of saying things without really thinking about them, and with you being new to this whole socializing thing.
He trailed off, his arm tightening around her waist.
You're awfully sweet, Cress. I don't want to hurt you.
She gulped, her mouth feeling suddenly chalky. Never had she thought that such kind words could sting, but she couldn't help feeling that his compliment didn't mean what she wanted it to mean. She peeled her head off his shoulder.
You think I'm naive?
Sure, a little, he said, so matter-of-factly that it seemed less of an insult than being called sweet. But mostly I just think I'm not the best person to demonstrate all the goodness humanity has to offer. I don't want you to be too disappointed when you realize that.
Cress nodded her fingers in her lap.
I know you better than you think, Captain Thorn. I know that you're smart and brave and thoughtful and kind and
charming.
Charming and
charismatic.
Charismatic and
handsome.
She pressed her lips and glared at him, but his mocking grin had swept away any hints of sincerity.
Sorry, he said. Please continue.
Perhaps more vain than I'd realized.
He threw his head back and laughed. Then, to her surprise, he reached over and took her hand, his other arm still around her waist.
For having such a limited social experience, you, my dear, are an excellent judge of character.
I don't need experience. You can try to hide it behind your bad reputation and criminal escapades, but I can see the truth.
Still beaming, he nudged her with his shoulder.
That on the inside, I'm really just a sappy, lovelorn romantic?
She dug her toes into the sand.
No. That you're a hero.
A hero? Ha ha, that's even better.
And it's true.
He hid his face behind his hand, dragging Cress's hand along with it. It occurred to her that this entire conversation was a joke to him.
But how could he not see it?
You're killing me, Cress.
When have you ever seen me do anything that would be considered heroic? Rescuing you from the satellite was all Cinder's idea.
You're the one who kept us from crashing and got us through the desert.
I'm not talking about any of that. She yanked her hand out of his grip.
What about when you tried to raise money to help pay for android assistance for the elderly? That was heroic, and you were only 11.
His smile slipped away. How did you know about that?
I did my research,
she said, crossing her arms. Thorne scratched his jaw, his confidence momentarily thrown. All right, he said slowly. I stole a necklace from my mom and tried to sell it. When I got caught, I figured they wouldn't punish me if they thought I'd been trying to do a good thing. And since I had to give the money back either way, it didn't really matter. So I made up the story about giving the money to charity. She frowned. But if that's the case, what were you really going to do with it? He sighed dreamily. Buy a hover racer? The Neon Spark 8000. Man, I really wanted that. Cress blinked. A hover racer? A toy? Fine, she said, smothering the twinge of disappointment.
What about when you released that tiger from the zoo?
Really? You think that was heroic?
He was a poor sad animal, locked up his whole life. You must have felt bad for him.
Not exactly. I grew up with robotic cats instead of real pets, so I thought that if I let him out, he would bow to my every whim and I could take him to school and be ridiculously popular because I was the kid with the pet tiger. He waved his hand through the air, as if he could illustrate his story as he spoke. Of course, the second he was out and everyone went running for their lives, I realized how stupid that was. He rested his elbow on his knee, cupping his chin. This is a fun game. What else do you have? Cress could feel her worldview crumbling. All those hours of scouring his records, justifying his mistakes, certain that she alone knew the true Carswell Thorne. What about Kate Fallow? She said, almost dreading his response. He cocked his head. Kate Fallow. Kate Fallow.
When you were 13, some classmates stole her port screen and you stood up for her. You tried to get it back?
Oh, that Kate Fallow. Wow. When you really research, don't you? She chewed on her lip, watching him for a reaction, something to say that in this one instance, at least, she had been right. He rescued that poor girl. He'd been her hero.
Actually, I did have a little bit of a crush on Kate Fallow, he said distractedly. I wonder what she's up to these days.
Her heart fluttered, grasping at the slim strings of hope.
She's studying to be an architect.
Ah, that makes sense. She was really good at math.
So, don't you see how heroic that was? How selfless? How valiant?
The corner of his lips twitched, but it was half-hearted and quickly faded as he turned his face away from her. He opened his mouth to speak, but hesitated, before finally he sought out her hand again.
Yeah, I guess you're right, he said, squeezing.
Maybe there's a little bit of a hero in me after all. But really, Cress, only a little.
Chapter 28. They decided to spend an extra day in the camp, to make sure Cress was fully recovered, but set out early the following morning, packing up their tents and mats beneath a still dark sky. Gina told Cress that they should arrive in Kufra by late afternoon, and that by getting such an early start, they would cover a lot of ground before the scorching heat claimed the sand. They ate a quick meal of dried meats, gathered some wild dates from the trees, and left the sanctuary of the oasis. Though it required a lot of careful repacking of trade goods and equipment, Cress was given a camel to ride. She was grateful. The mere thought of walking made her want to break down in sobs. And yet, she soon found that the beast was not the epitome of comfort either. Within hours, her hands ached from clenching the reins, and her calves were red and irritated. The cloak that the caravanners loaned her kept her better protected from the sun, but as the day stretched on,
There was no respite from the heat. They traveled east, parallel with the mountains. Thorn stayed at her side, a steadying hand on one of the saddlebags, and the tip of his new, lighter cane skimming the sand. Still wearing the blindfold, he walked with deceptive ease. Kress offered to let him ride the camel numerous times, but he always declined. She sensed that it was becoming a matter of pride. He was proving, perhaps to himself, that he could walk without assistance, that he could be independent, that he could keep a confident smile on his face as he did so. They spent most of the morning in silence, and Kress couldn't help losing herself in daydreams that mostly revolved around his fingertips tracing patterns on the inside of her wrist. By midday, they were under attack by the relentless heat and windblown sand that pummeled them, trying its best to seep into the folds of their clothes. But the sun was no longer on their faces, and gradually the dunes gave way to a hard, rocky plateau. In the afternoon, when the sun was at its worst, they came across a dried-up riverbed and stopped to rest. They found a shaded spot in the overhang of a squat cliff, and two of the men wandered off and returned a while later with all their water canteens full to the brim. Gina explained that there was a waterhole hidden in a nearby cope of rocks that was fed from the same underground spring Kufra was situated on, the trading city where they were headed. Climbing back onto the camel after the break was torture, but Kress reminded herself that anything was better than walking. The afternoon brought more rocky lowlands, followed by a few hours of dunes. They passed a snake, and Kress found that she was the only one who was afraid of it, despite Quende confirming that it was poisonous. The snake curled up on itself and watched them pass by with lazy eyes, not even bothering to hiss or bare its fangs like the snakes on the net dramas always did. Still, from her vantage point, Kress carefully monitored where Thorn stepped, and her heartbeat didn't slow until the snake could no longer be seen behind them. Then, when Kress was sure the insides of her thighs had been rubbed raw, Thorn reached up and fumbled around until his palm landed on her knee. "Do you hear that?" She listened, but all she heard was the familiar soft clopping of the camels. "What?" "Civilization." She squeezed the camel's reins, but it wasn't until they crested the next dune that the noise separated itself from the dead desert silence, and she saw it. A city sprouted up in front of them, unfolding in the desert among sheltering rocky cliffs. The buildings were all compacted together, but even from this distance, Kress could see the blur of green trees sprouting between them. It did not seem possible that a city could exist in the middle of such a harsh, unforgiving desert, and yet, there it was, without any preamble. One step, desert, the next, paradise. "You're right," Kress breathed, eyes wide. "We're almost there. We made it." "What does it look like?" "I don't know where to start. It looks crowded. There are people and buildings and streets and trees." Thorn laughed. "You just described every town on the planet." She couldn't help giggling along with him, suddenly overcome with elation. "I'm sorry. Let me think. Most of the buildings are made out of stone, or maybe clay, and they're kind of tan, peachy color, and the whole city is surrounded by a tall stone wall, and there are a lot of palms on all the streets. There's a lake that looks like it stretches right down to the middle of the city, almost from end to end, and I see little boats in it, and so many trees and plants, and I think to the north, beyond the houses, I think they're growing crops of some sort." "Oh,
what?"
"Oh, what?"
"Animals. At least a few dozen. Goats, maybe? And, oh, that one over there has sheep. Oh, they look just like they do on the net."
"Tell me about the people." She tore her focus away from the creatures that were lazing in what shade they could find and tried to pick out the people wandering the streets. Though it was moving into evening,
What appeared to be the main road was still teeming with small open-air shops, vibrantly patterned fabric walls fluttering in the breeze.
There's a lot of them, mostly dressed in robes like we are, but there's a lot more color.
And how big is the city?
Hundreds of buildings!
Thorn smirked. Try to temper that enthusiasm, city girl, I told everyone that we met in Los Angeles.
Right, sorry, it's just... We made it, Captain.
His hand slipped down her leg, wrapping loosely around her ankle. I'll be glad to get off these sand dunes, but there will be a lot more things to trip over here than in the desert. Try not to go too far, all right?
She stared down at his profile and recognized the strained look of concern in the tilt of his lips, the crease between his eyebrows. She hadn't seen that look since they stumbled across the caravanners, and she'd thought he was growing more comfortable with his blindness, but maybe he'd only been trying to hide his weakness from the others.
I wouldn't leave you, she said.
It was clear from the moment they rolled into town that the caravan was well-known and expected, and late. The caravanners wasted no time in setting up a spot amid the shops and unloading their goods, while Cress tried to drink in the architecture and details and beauty that surrounded her. Though the city had appeared bleach and sandy from afar, up close, she could pick out vibrant swatches of orange and pink, decorating the sides of buildings and cobalt blue tiles lining doorways and steps. Almost every surface was bedecked in some decoration, from gold trim to intricately carved archways to an enormous fountain that stood in the middle of the main square. Cress peered into the burbling water as they passed, mesmerized by the starburst pattern laid out on the fountain's base.
"What do you think?" asked Gina.
Cress beamed.
"It's breathtaking."
Gina scanned the surrounding market stalls and building fronts as if she'd never really looked at them before.
"This has always been one of my favorite stops along our route, but you would hardly recognize it from a couple decades ago. When I was first learning the trade, Kufra was one of the most beautiful cities in the Sahara. But then, the plague struck. Nearly two-thirds of the population was annihilated in only a few years, and many more fled to other towns, or left Africa altogether. Homes and businesses were abandoned, crops left to burn beneath the sun. They've been trying to recover ever since."
Cress blinked and looked again, past the beautiful ornamentation and vibrantly painted walls, trying to see the town that Gina described, but she couldn't.
"It doesn't seem abandoned."
"Not here, on the main square, but if you head out to the northern or eastern neighborhoods, it's practically a ghost town. Very sad."
"It was very wealthy then," said Thorn, cocking his head.
"Before the plague." "Oh, yes. Kufra was on many of the trade routes between the uranium mines in Central Africa and the Mediterranean. One of Earth's most valuable resources, and we nearly have a monopoly on it. Excepting Australia, but there's plenty of demand to share."
"Uranium," Thorn said.
"For nuclear power. It also powers most of today's spaceship engines."
Thorn whistled, sounding impressed, though Cress thought he had probably already known that.
"Follow me," said Gina. "There's a hotel around the corner."
Gina led them through the cramped maze of market stalls, passing everything from crates overflowing with dark sugar dates to tables lined with fresh goat cheeses to a Medroid clinic offering free blood scans. Leaving the market lanes behind, they passed through a worn gate into a courtyard garden, filled with more palms and a tree with big yellow fruits hanging from its branches. Cress beamed when she recognized them and ached to tell Thorn about the lemons, but managed to smother her excitement. They stepped into a small lobby with an arched doorway that led into a dining area where some people were crowded around a table playing cards. The room smelled sweetly perfumed and heady, almost intoxicating. Gina approached a girl who sat behind the desk, and they spoke in their other language before she turned back to them.
"They're going to keep your room on our tab. They have a small kitchen here. Order whatever you need. I have work to do, but I will ask about some shoes for you, when I have a chance.
Cress thanked her repeatedly, until Gina trotted off to complete her business.
Room 8 upstairs, said the clerk,
handing Cress a small tag embedded with a sensor key.
And please do join us for our nightly Royals competition in the lobby restaurant to your left. The first 3 hands are complimentary to guests.
Thorn cocked his head toward the dining area.
You don't say.
Cress eyed the players gathered around the table.
Do you want to go see?
No, not right now. Let's find our room. On the 2nd floor, Cress found the door marked with a black painted 8. As she swiped the tag and opened the door, her attention landed first on a bed set against the wall, draped with cream-colored netting that hung from 4 tall posts. Pillows and blankets with gold embroidery and tasseled were more elaborate by far than the linens she'd had on the satellite, and infinitely more inviting.
Describe, said Thorn, shutting the door behind them.
She gulped.
Well, there's a bed.
Thorn gasped.
What? This hotel room comes with a bed?
She scowled.
I mean, there's only one.
We are married, darling.
He wandered around the room until his cane struck the writing desk.
That's a little desk, she said. There's a net screen above it, and over here's a window.
She pulled back the curtains. The angled sunlight cut across the floor. We can see the whole main street from here. She heard a thud and spun around. Thorn had kicked off his shoes and collapsed, spread eagle, on the mattress. She smiled, wanting little more than to crawl up beside him and rest her head on his shoulder and sleep for a long, long time. But there was one thing she wanted even more. Through the room's only other door, she could make out a tiny porcelain sink and an old-fashioned clawfoot tub.
I'm going to take a bath.
Good idea. I'll be right behind you.
Her eyes widened, but Thorn was already laughing. He propped himself up on his elbows.
I mean, he said, flicking his fingers through the air, I'll take one when you're done.
Right,
she murmured, and slipped into the washroom. Cress may not have ever been in an earthen washroom before, but she knew enough to realize that this was not the top of the latrine technological advancement. The small overhead light functioned via an actual switch on the wall, rather than computer, and the sink faucet had 2 water-spotted handles for warm and cold. The shower was a giant metal disc positioned over the freestanding tub, and a lot of the white porcelain had been damaged with time, revealing black cast iron underneath. A bar was hung with plush white towels, in far better shape than the towel Cress had used on the satellite. She pulled her clothes off with more than one sigh of contentment. Her bottom layers clung to her with a layer of sweat and grime. The bandages on her feet were filled with sand and dried blood, but the blisters had been reduced to raw, pinkish skin. She threw everything into a pile on the floor and turned on the water. It came on hard and cold. She got in as soon as she could stand it and found that it felt shockingly good against the sunburns on her face and legs. The water heated fast, and soon a cloud of steam was wafting up around her. She found a bar of soap packaged in a waxy paper. With a moan of ecstasy, Cress sat down in the water and lathered up her hair, amazed at how short and light and easy to clean it was. As she soaked, she started to hum, imagining her favorite opera music blaring through the satellite speakers, surrounding and uplifting her. Her quiet humming turned into singing, the words whimsical and foreign. She sang one of her slow Italian favorites, humming the melody when she forgot the words. By the time she reached the end of the song, she was beaming beneath the fall of water. Cress opened her eyes. Thorn was leaning against the washroom's doorway. She pushed herself to the back of the tub and wrapped her arms over her chest, a cascade of water splashing onto the floor.
Captain!
His grin widened.
Where did you learn to sing like that?
Her face flamed.
I'm not wearing any clothes.
He raised an eyebrow. Yes, I'm aware of that. He pointed to his eyes. No need to rub it in.
Cress curled her toes against the bottom of the tub. You shouldn't have been... You shouldn't...
He held up his hands. All right, fine, I'm sorry, but... That was beautiful, Cress. Really. What language was it?
She shivered, despite the steam.
Old Italian? I don't know what all the words mean.
Huh.
He turned toward the sink. Well, I liked it.
Her mortification began slipping away as she watched him fumble around for the faucet.
Do you see any washcloths?
She told him where to find them, and after knocking a second bar of soap onto the floor, he had found a clean cloth and was soaking it in the sink.
I think I might go down to the lobby for a bit, he said, swiping the cloth over his face and leaving streaks of clean amid the dirt.
Why?
See if I can get more information on this place. If we can find one of those abandoned neighborhoods, that would be the best place for Cinder and the others to come get us, after we contact them.
If you give me a minute, I can... She trailed off, gaping at Thorn as he peeled off his shirt. Her heart stuck in her throat as she watched him wring out the cloth before washing off his arms and neck, chest and underarms. Setting the cloth aside, he cupped his hands beneath the faucet and slicked water through his hair. Her fingers twitched with a sudden, irrepressible desire to touch him.
That's all right, he said, as if she hadn't just lost the ability to form coherent sentences. I'll bring us back some food.
Cress splashed herself with the water, willing her brain to focus.
But you said there are things to trip over and that I shouldn't leave you and... Don't you want me to come?
His hand searched around the walls until it stumbled across one of the hanging towels. He pulled it off the rack and briskly rubbed it over his face and through his hair, making it stand on end.
No need, I won't be long.
But how will you...
Really, Cress, I'll be fine. Maybe you could take a look at that net screen, see if you can figure out some way to contact the crew.
He grabbed his shirt from the counter and shook it out, sending dust and sand flying, before pulling it over his head. He retied the bandana over his eyes.
Be honest, do I look like a famous wanted criminal right now?
He struck a pose, complete with dazzling smile. With the messy hair, filthy clothes, and bandana, she had to admit that he was almost unrecognizable from his prison photo. Yet somehow, still heart-throbbingly gorgeous. She sighed.
No, you don't.
Good. I'll see about getting us some clean clothes while I'm down there, too.
Are you sure you don't need me?
I was overreacting before. We're in civilization now.
I've got this.
He was all charisma as he blew her a kiss and left. Chapter 29. Stepping back from the Rampian's hulking side, Cinder shaded her eyes with one arm and peered up at the slipshod work. Jason was still up on one of the squeaky metal ladders that townspeople had brought them, painting over all that remained of the ship's signature decoration. The lounging naked lady, the mascot that Thorn had painted himself before Cinder had ever met him. Cinder had hated the painting from the moment she laid eyes on it, but now she was sad to see it covered up, like she was erasing a part of Thorn, a part of his memory. But word had gotten out through the media that the wanted ship had this very specific marking, and that was unacceptable. Swiping a bead of sweat from her brow, Cinder surveyed the rest of their work. They didn't have enough paint to cover the entire ship, so they'd opted to focus on the main ramp's enormous side panel, so that it would at least look like that exterior piece had been fully replaced, which wasn't uncommon, rather than looking that they had tried to cover something up, which would defeat the purpose. Unfortunately, it seemed that as much black paint had ended up on the dusty ground and the townspeople, who had come out in droves to help them, than had actually ended up on the ship. Cinder herself had paint dried on her collarbone, her temple, clumped in her hair, and stuck in the joints of her metal hand, but she was relatively unscathed compared with some of their assistants. The children in particular,
eager to be helpful at first, had soon made a game of seeing who could paint up their bodies to look the most cyborg. It was a strange sort of honor. Since Cinder had arrived, she'd been seeing this mimicry more and more. The backs of t-shirts illustrated with bionic spines, shoes decorated with bits of assorted metal, necklaces hung with washers and vintage lug nuts. One girl had even been proud to show Cinder her new, real tattoo, wires and robotic joints overtaking the skin of her left foot. Cinder had smiled awkwardly and resisted the urge to tell her that the tattoo wasn't cybernetically accurate. The attention made Cinder uncomfortable. Not because she wasn't flattered, but because she wasn't used to it. She wasn't used to being accepted by strangers, even appreciated. She wasn't used to being admired.
"Hey, mongrels, try to stay in the lines."
Cinder looked up just as Jason flicked his paintbrush, sending a splatter of black paint at the three children beneath him. They all shrieked with laughter and ran for cover beneath the ship's underside. Wiping her hands on her cargo pants, Cinder went to look at the finger painting the kids had been doodling on the other side of the ramp's plating. Simple stick figures depicted a family holding hands, two adults, three children of various heights, and at the end, Cinder. She knew it was her by the ponytail jutting out from the side of her head and how one of the stick figure's legs was twice as wide as the other. She shook her head, baffled. The ladder shook beside her as Jason clambered down.
"You should wipe it off," he said, unhooking a damp rag from his belt.
"It's not hurting anything." Scoffing, Jason draped the rag over her shoulders.
"The whole point of this is to get rid of obvious markings."
"But it's so small."
"Since when are you so sentimental?"
She blew a strand of hair out of her face. "Fine." Pulling the rag off her shoulder, she set to scrubbing the paint off before it could dry. "I thought I was the one giving the orders around here."
"I hope you don't really think I'm here just to be bossed around some more."
Jason dropped his paintbrush into a bucket at the ladder's base.
"I've taken enough orders in my life."
Cinder refolded the rag, searching for a spot that wasn't already soaked through with paint.
"You have a funny way of showing loyalty."
Chuckling to himself, though Cinder wasn't sure what he found so amusing, Jason stepped back and peered up at the enormous black square that now made up the ship's main ramp.
"Good enough."
Scrubbing away the last bit of the painting, her own amateur portrait, Cinder stepped back to join him. The ship no longer looked like the Rampian she'd come to think of as home. It no longer looked like the stolen ship of Captain Carswell Thorne. She swallowed the lump in her throat. All around her, strangers were helping to gather up the painting supplies, scrubbing paint off one another's faces, pausing to take enormous drinks of water, and smiling. Smiling because they'd spent the morning together, accomplishing something. Somehow, though Cinder knew she was at the center of it all, she couldn't help feel disconnected from the camaraderie, the friendships that had been forged over years of being part of one community. And soon, she would be leaving. Maybe, someday, even returning to Luna.
"So, when do we start your flying lessons?"
Cinder started.
"Excuse me?" "Ship needs a pilot," said Jason, nodding toward the front of the ship, where the cockpit windows were glinting almost blindingly bright in the sun. "It's time you learned how to fly it yourself."
"But aren't you my new pilot?" He smirked.
"In case you haven't noticed, people tend to get killed around you. I don't think that's a trend that's bound to stop anytime soon."
A boy, a few years younger than Cinder, ran up to offer her a bottle of water. But Jason took it out of his hand before Cinder could, and took a few long drafts. Cinder would have been annoyed if his words, at once so practical and so painful, weren't keeping her from feeling anything other than shock.
"I'll start teaching you the basics after we eat," he said, passing the bottle to her. Cinder took it numbly. "Don't worry, it's not as hard as it looks."
"Fine,
Cinder finished off the water. It's not like I'm busy trying to prevent a full-scale war or anything.
Is that what you're doing?
He eyed her suspiciously.
Here I thought we were painting a spaceship.
A comm pinged in the corner of Cinder's vision. From Dr. Erland. She tensed, but the comm was only two tiny words that made her entire world start spinning again.
He's awake, she said, mostly to herself. Wolf is awake.
Turning away from the ship and lingering townsfolk, Cinder thrust the empty water bottle into Jason's stomach and took off running toward the hotel. Wolf was sitting up when Cinder burst into the hotel room. His feet were bare, his torso still covered in bandages. He didn't look at all surprised to see Cinder, but then he would have heard her pounding up the old wooden stairs. Probably smelled her, too.
Wolf! Thank the stars, we were so worried. How do you feel?
His eyes, duller than usual, flickered past her toward the hallway. He frowned, like he was confused. A second later, Cinder heard footsteps and turned just as Dr. Erland brushed past her, carrying a medical kit.
He's still under heavy painkillers, said the doctor. Try not to ask too many confusing questions, if you would.
Gulping, Cinder followed the doctor to Wolf's side.
What happened?
Said Wolf, his words barely slurred. He sounded exhausted.
We were attacked by a thaumaturge, said Cinder. Part of her felt like she should take Wolf's hand, but the most intimate contact she'd ever had with him before was the occasional friendly punch to the jaw. It wouldn't have felt natural, so instead, she stood just within arm's reach, her hands fisted in her pockets.
You were shot. We didn't know, but you're all right.
He's all right, isn't he, Doctor?
Erland flashed a light past Wolf's eyes. Wolf flinched back.
He is better than I would have expected, he said. It seems you're on target to make a full recovery, so long as you can avoid reopening your wounds in the meantime.
We're on Earth, said Cinder, not sure if that was obvious to Wolf or not. In Africa. We're safe here, for now.
But Wolf seemed distracted and upset as he tilted his head back and sniffed. His frown deepened.
Where's Scarlet?
Cinder grimaced. She had known the question would be coming. She had known that she wouldn't know how to answer when it did. His expression darkened.
I can't smell her. Like she hasn't been here in... Like she isn't here.
Dr. Erland pressed a thermometer against Wolf's brow, but Wolf snatched it away before it could gauge his temperature.
Where is she?
Miffed, the doctor fisted his hand on his waist.
Now that is precisely the type of jerky movement you should be avoiding.
Wolf snarled, showing his sharp teeth.
She's not here, said Cinder, forcing herself not to shrink away when Wolf turned his glare on her.
She struggled to form an explanation.
The thaumaturge took her. During the fight on the ship, she was alive. I don't think she was even injured, but the thaumaturge took her aboard the pod ship. Jason thinks she needed Scarlet to pilot it.
Wolf's jaw went slack. With terror, with denial. He jerked his head no.
Wolf, how long? How long ago?
She scrunched her shoulders against her neck.
5 days.
He grimaced and turned away, his face contorting with pain that had nothing to do with his wounds. Cinder took half a step toward him, but paused. There were no words that would mean anything to him. No explanation, no apology. So she braced herself for Wolf's anger instead. She expected fury and destruction. His pupils had narrowed to pinpricks, and his fists started to flex. Though Cinder had practiced her mind control sporadically on Jason and the doctor since they'd arrived in Farafra, it would be a true test of her abilities if Wolf lost control. And she could sense it brimming inside him. Fear burning and roiling. Panic writhing inside his chest. The animal straining to be unleashed inside the man. But then, Wolf's breath hitched
and all the fury drained out of him with a shudder. Like a man shot fatally through the heart, he collapsed over his knees, covering his head with his good arm like he wanted to block out the world. Cinder stood, staring. All her senses were attuned to Wolf, focused on the energy and emotions that clouded around him. It was like watching a candle extinguish. It was like watching him die. Gulping, Cinder sank into a crouch in front of him. She considered reaching out and placing a hand on his arm, but she couldn't bring herself to do it. It was too much like an invasion, especially when her gift was attuned to him like this. When she was watching him break and crumble in front of her. She longed to put him back together, to take away the vulnerability that didn't fit him. But it was his right to mourn. It was his right to be terrified for Scarlet, as she was.
"I'm sorry," she whispered. "But we will find her. We're trying to come up with some way to get to Luna, and we'll find her. We'll rescue..."
His head jolted up so fast that Cinder nearly fell over from surprise. His eyes had brightened again.
"Rescue her?" he seethed, his knuckles turning white. "You don't know what they'll do to her, what they've already done to her."
It happened fast. One moment, he was a broken man, crumpled over his own knees. The next, he was on his feet, grabbing the frame of the bed and upending it against the wall. The medical kit crashed to the floor. The room shook. Crying out, Cinder scurried backward. Then the chaos quieted, just as suddenly. Wolf froze, teetered on his feet, and fell so hard onto the floor that the hotel trembled from the impact. Dr. Erlon stood above his prone body, empty syringe in his hand, glaring at Cinder over his thin-framed spectacles. She gulped.
"Wouldn't it be handy," said the doctor, "if we had someone here with the mental faculties capable of controlling one of his kind when he goes on just that sort of a tirade?"
Hands shaking, Cinder pushed her mess of hair out of her face. "I was getting around to it."
"Well, faster next time, if I might make a suggestion."
Sighing, he tossed the syringe onto the room's small desk and glowered down at the unconscious man. Blood was beginning to seep through the bandages beneath Wolf's shoulder blade.
"Perhaps it will be best to keep him sedated, for the time being."
"Perhaps." The doctor's lips puckered, wrinkles creasing down his cheeks.
"Do you still have those tranquilizer darts I gave you?"
"Oh, please." Cinder forced herself to stand, though her legs still shook. "Do you have any idea how many times I've nearly died since you gave me those? They're long gone." Dr. Erland harrumphed.
"I'll make you some more. I have a feeling you're going to need them."
Chapter 30. Cress hummed to herself as she rubbed a towel through her hair, amazed at how the weight of it no longer pulled on her. She emerged from the washroom rejuvenated. Her skin was bright pink from scrubbing, and she'd managed to get almost all the dirt out from beneath her fingernails. The bottoms of her feet and the insides of her legs were still sore, but all those complaints were petty compared to the sensation of unexpected luxury. A soft towel, short, clean hair, more water than she could drink in a year. Or at least, her long bath had made it seem endless. Cress eyed her pile of clothes and couldn't bear to put them back on. As Thorne hadn't returned yet, she pulled a blanket off the bed and wrapped it around herself instead. Then, struggled to kick the corners out of her way as she crossed to the net screen on the wall. Screen on. It was set to an animated net feed that showed orange octopuses and blue children bopping around to tech beats. Cress changed it to the local news feed, then opened a new box in the corner to check their GPS coordinates. Kufra. A trading city at the eastern edge of the Sahara. She zoomed out on the map and tried to pinpoint where the satellite would have landed, though it was impossible to gauge how far they'd walked. Probably not half as far as it had seemed. Regardless, there was nothing, nothing in the vast open sands to the north and west. She shuddered, realizing how close they'd come to being food for the vultures. She sent the map away, beginning to concoct a strategy for contacting the Rampian. Though they didn't have the DCOM chip anymore, that didn't mean the Rampian was completely out of touch. After all, with or without tracking equipment, it would still have communication capabilities and a net protocol address. She could have hacked into the military database and tracked down the original MPA for the ship, but it would be a waste of time. If it was that easy, the Commonwealth would have been able to contact the Rampian as soon as they had determined which ship they were after. Which meant the address had been changed, probably not long after Thorne's desertion. Which most likely meant the auto control system had been replaced. Hopefully Thorne would have some information on where and when the new system had been purchased, or what programming it had been replaced with. If he didn't know anything, well, she was going to have to get creative. That was not worth worrying about just yet. First things first. She had to make sure there was someone aboard that ship to contact. She began by checking the news feeds. A simple search made it clear that, at this time, the Earthen media had no more information on the whereabouts of Lynn Cinder than they'd had 5 days ago. Luna Satellite. She snapped her attention to the news anchor who was rambling in a foreign language. Most likely the language that the caravan hunter had first spoken to them. Cress frowned, thinking she was only hearing things. But then, as she squinted at the man's lips, she thought she heard Sahara and, again, lunar. Set translation overdub to universal language. The language switched as the news anchor was replaced with video footage from a vast desert, a horrendously familiar desert. And there, in the middle of it, was the wreckage that she and Thorne had abandoned. Her satellite, still attached to the obliterated lunar podship, and the parachute strung out behind it. A large square was cut from the fabric. She gulped. It wasn't long before the gist of the story had come through. Multiple witnesses had seen something drop out of the sky. The blaze could be seen as far north as the Mediterranean, and the satellite had been discovered 2 days later. There was no question that it was lunar built. There was no question that someone had survived and abandoned the wreckage, taking what supplies they could carry. Authorities were still scouring the desert. They did not know whether they were looking for one survivor or many, but they could be sure they were looking for lunars, and in the state of tension between Luna and Earth, they were not willing to risk the Queen's wrath if these fugitives were not found. Cress buried her hands in her damp, tangled hair. The implications hit her in fast succession. If any of the caravanners learned about the crash, they would no doubt suspect that Cress and Thorne were the survivors. They would turn them in, and when the authorities found Thorne, they would recognize him immediately. And not just the caravanners, everyone would be suspicious about strangers right now. But then, a light amid the panic. If Lynn Cinder learned about this wreckage, then she too would know what had happened. She would know that Thorne and Cress were alive. The crew would come for them. It was all a question of who found them first. Cress ripped herself out of the chair and threw on her dirty clothes, ignoring how they scratched against her skin. She had to tell Thorne. She was cautious, creeping down the hallway, trying to act natural, but not knowing what natural looked like. She was already aware how much her fair complexion and hair made her stand out here, and she didn't want to draw any more attention than she had to. The noise from the hotel lounge roared up the staircase, laughter and bellowing and the clinking of glasses. Cress peeked over the banister. The crowd had quadrupled since they'd left the lobby. This must be a popular hour. Men and women loitered around the bar and card tables, snacking on bowls of dried fruit. The crowd around a corner table hollered in delight, and Cress was relieved to spot Thorne in their midst, still blindfolded and holding a hand of cards. She crept through the crowd toward him, her mouth watering from unfamiliar, spicy aromas. The crowd shifted, and she froze. There was a woman on Thorne's lap. She was net drama beautiful, with warm brown skin and full lips and hair that hung in dozens of long, thin braids dyed various shades of blue. She wore simple khaki shorts and a blousy top, but somehow she made them look elegant. And she had the longest legs Cress had ever seen. The woman leaned forward and pushed a pile of plastic chips toward one of the other players. Thorn tilted his head in laughter. He took one of the few chips still in front of him and flipped it over his knuckles a few times before tucking it into the woman's palm. In response, she trailed her fingers down his neck. The air burned around Cress, clinging to her skin and pressing against her, tightening around her throat until she couldn't breathe. Suffocating, she turned and dashed from the lounge. Her knees were shaking as she ratcheted up the stairs. She found door number 8 and dumbly shook the knob, seeing those fingernails teasing his skin again and again before she realized that the door was locked. The key was inside, beside the washroom sink. She sobbed and slumped against the wall, beating her forehead against the frame. Stupid, stupid, stupid. Cress? She spun around, swiping at the hot tears. Gina stood before her, having just emerged from her own room down the hall. What's wrong? Cress ducked her head away.
I'm locked out, and Carswell is...
She dissolved, crying into her palms as Gina rushed forward to embrace her.
Oh, there, there. It's not worth getting so worked up about.
This only made Cress cry harder. How twisted their story had become. Thorn was not her husband, despite their made-up romance, despite the nights spent in his arms. He had every right to flirt with whomever he chose, and yet... How wrong she'd been. How stupid.
You're safe now, Gina said, rubbing her back. Everything is going to be fine. Here, I brought you some shoes.
Sniffing, Cress looked down at the simple canvas shoes in Gina's hand. She took them with shaking hands, stammering out her gratitude, though it was buried beneath hiccups.
Listen, I was just going to meet Niels for a late meal. Would you like to join us?
Cress shook her head.
I don't want to go back down there.
Gina patted Cress's hair.
You can't stay up here without your key. We'll slip right past the lobby. There's a restaurant on the corner. Does that sound nice?
Cress tried to calm herself. All she wanted was to get into her room and hide under the bed. But she would need to go talk to the girl at the desk again to get another key. She would bring even more attention to herself, especially now that her eyes were red and her face flushed. People would talk, and she suddenly remembered how bad it was that people would talk. And she didn't want to still be standing in the hallway, sniffling and miserable, when Thorn came back. If she could have some time to calm down, then she could speak to him rationally. She would go on like her heart wasn't shattered.
All right, she said. Yes, thank you.
Gina kept her securely tucked beneath her arm and hurried them both down the stairs and through the lobby. She guided her along the walkway that lined the main road. The crowd had dwindled, many of the shops now covered up for the night.
It isn't right to see such a pretty girl crying like that, especially after all you've been through.
Cress sobbed again.
Don't tell me you and Carswell had a fight after surviving the Great Sahara together.
He's not...
She ducked her head, watching sand slip down the cracks of the clay pavers. Gina took her elbow.
He's not what?
Cress sniffled into her screen.
Nothing. Never mind.
There was a pause before Gina spoke, slowly.
You're not really married, are you?
Clenching her teeth, Cress shook her head. Gina lightly stroked her arm.
We all have our secrets, and I can venture to guess your reasons. If I'm right, I don't blame you for the lies.
She leaned close, so that her forehead touched Cress's frizzing hair.
You're Luna, aren't you?
Her feet stumbled and froze. She ripped herself away from Gina's gentle touch, instincts telling her to run, to hide. But Gina's expression was full of sympathy, and the panic quickly fizzled.
I caught word of the fallen satellite. I figured it must have been you, but it's all right.
She tugged Cress forward again.
Lunas aren't so rare around here. Some of us have even come to appreciate having you around.
Cress stumbled along beside her.
Really?
The woman tilted her head, squinting at Cress.
Mostly, we've found that your people just want to keep to themselves. After going through all the trouble of making it to Earth, why risk getting caught and sent back after all?
Cress let herself be led on as she listened, surprised at how rationally Gina was speaking about it all. All the Earthen media had led her to believe there was such a hatred toward Lunars, that she could never be accepted. But what if it wasn't true at all?
I hope you won't be offended by my asking, Gina continued. But are you ungifted?
She nodded dumbly, and was surprised at the smug grin that passed over Gina's face, like she'd guessed it all along.
There's Niels.
Cress's thoughts were swimming. To think that she and Thorn could have told them the truth from the start. But no, he was still a wanted criminal. She would have to think of a new story as to why she and Thorn were together. Did they think he was Lunar too? Niels and Quende were standing outside a big, dusty vehicle with enormous traction wheels. Its hood was up, a cord plugged into a generator attached to a building, and a wide door was open in the back. They were loading things into it, many sacks of goods that Cress thought she recognized from the camels.
Making room for the new cargo? Said Gina,
coming up to stand with the men. If Niels was surprised to see Cress there without her husband, he didn't show it.
About done, he said, dusting his hands. The engine's near a complete charge. Should have no problem getting us to Farafra and back without having to break into the petroleum reserves.
Cress glanced at Gina. You're not staying? Gina clicked her tongue.
Oh, Jamal and a few others are, but we've had a new order, so we need to make a special trip. There's always more business to attend to.
But you just got here. What about the camels? Niels laughed.
They'll stay in the town stables and be happy for the break. Sometimes they suit our needs, and sometimes we need something a bit faster.
He thumped a palm down on the side of the truck.
Have you been crying?
It's nothing, she said, dipping her head.
Gina.
Gina's hand tightened on Cress's arm, and she responded to his unspoken query in their other language. Cress flushed, wishing she knew what Gina was saying. Then he smiled cryptically and nodded. Cress was grabbed suddenly from behind, a hand clamped over her mouth, muffling her startled cry as she was shoved past Gina, past Niels. Her head was forced down as she was thrust into the back of the vehicle, banging her shins on the bumper. The hatch slammed shut. Pitch blackness surrounded her. Niels barked something she didn't understand, and then the engine rumbled beneath her. She heard two more doors slam near the front of the vehicle.
No!
She threw herself at the hatch, pounding her fists against the metal. She screamed until her throat went hoarse, until the rumble and sway of the vehicle grew rough, and the bumps threw her against a pile of bolted fabrics. Her mind was still spinning when, not minutes later, she felt the vibrations change. They'd already left the paved streets of Kufra behind.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.